Make them merciful, God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding. We humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. And may we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 18th of January 2019, order proceedings. Confirmation of minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 22nd November, 25th December 2017. May I confirm the minutes are correct?
This item on the agenda affects the opportunity to pull rank. Moreover, the fact that I was first elected to this house on the 7th day of the Honorable Certificate of Defense back in 1972, perhaps also makes me appropriate that I could be the first one to congratulate the Honorable Member today. By your last week, I have been completed a public service for 35.5 years, and still going strong is a remarkable achievement. And throughout that time, the Honorable Member has always sought to go to honor without fear or favor. I am delighted that his well deserved banquet can also be enjoyed by his wife, now Lady Rose Bassano, who has been a pillar of strength for him. My sincere and hearty congratulations to the Honorable Member and to Lady Rose.
Honorable Chief Minister, Mr. Speaker, you've known him for 35 years, and you know that Joe Bassano is the hardest taskmaster that there is in Gibraltar politics. If you do nothing, Mr. Speaker, in your life, you will do nothing wrong. But if, of course, that it's wrong to do nothing. If you do things, Mr. Speaker, especially if you do a lot, it's likely that amongst all the good that you have done, you may also do something which is not entirely to the pleasure of all those around you. And Joe Bassano, Mr. Speaker, Sir Joe Bassano, MP, KCMG, as I believe his name will now feature, and in the onset of these proceedings, has done a lot for this community, Mr. Speaker. He has done perhaps more than most for this community. He therefore, in my view, Mr. Speaker, rightfully earned the respect of most, if not all, in our community. And he's delivered more than most for this community. To do so, therefore, necessarily, incurred the displeasure of some when he thought it necessary or appropriate in the public interest of Gibraltar to do so, and quite right, too, Mr. Speaker. He has been the person who has most developed in the public consciousness of Gibraltarians the doctrine that the right of self-determination is acquired through the attainment first of the self-sufficiency of a people. He is a man who's led on issues of union rights He's a man who's led on an issue of human rights. And of course, he was the man who, in great measure, led the battle on piracy. He led us through a difficult period when the Ministry of Defence was withdrawing the amount of spending it made in the Gibraltar economy. He transformed Gibraltarians into a community of home owners. He introduced the concept of the mandatory scholarship for undergraduates. And I can tell honourable members in the South and the community at large that when the time came to have the debate to prepare the manifesto for the 2011 general election, it was him leading the argument that we should introduce mandatory scholarship also for postgraduates in today's economy. He led on the concept of reclamation to gain land from the sea and to be able to extend further our community. And of course, one of the incarnations of which he is proud of is community care. Surprising, Mr. Speaker, that every quarter has a positive effect on the lives of so many of his fellow Gibraltarians. I won't say fellow temples, Mr. Speaker, I'll just speak to fellow Gibraltarians. But, Mr. Speaker, going back a little further, and perhaps in terms of that most opposite today, Mr. Speaker, this is a man who led in respect of the various processes that required opposition. So whether it was the Strasbourg process, the Lisbon process, or the Brussels process, and the bilateralism linked to the United Nations resolutions about the transfer of the greater sovereignty to Spain, they found a lot of opposition in Sergio Bassano from the mid-70s when the attempt began to try to stop Gibraltar into those processes. And then a few different speakers, Joe Bassano, he then was led the return of Gibraltar to the United Nations. Mr. Speaker, that return continued unabated whilst Joe Bassano was in government. It continued after a number of members were in government, except for the agreement between ourselves to attend the C24 after 2006. And Joe Bassano continued whilst he was in opposition, funding the ship out of his own pocket because he thought it in the interest of Gibraltar to turn up at New York every year on two occasions, and to go to the UN seminar, whether that might be held in the Pacific or in the Caribbean, where he is recognized by the Secretariat of the United Nations as an authority on the right of self-determination of the people of the non-self-governing authority. But in respect of the last in respect of the seminar, they paid his way for some time, because they wanted him involved in those deliberations of theirs. And to see that, therefore, in the context of all of that, and all of the things that the Bassano has done, which I cannot reflect just in the moment that we have here as we begin our parliamentary session, in the things I have written about the merit of this award since it was made, those who know Joe Bassano know everything that he has done, and anybody who studies the history of Gibraltar will realize the impact of the return to Gibraltar of Joe Bassano in 1972 and the effect it has had on the plans some others might have had for the future of this community. And therefore, in the grant of this honour, I'm actually the thing who's not just rightly recognized somebody who I think the whole community is proud to see take a mantle, but I see, Mr. Speaker, personally, huge vindication of the legitimacy of the stand that Joe Bassano has taken since 1972, and vindication, as I may say, for all those of us who have stood with him, and I don't just mean for election, but who have stood with him in respect of the defense of the principles that he has espoused, in respect of the policies that he has espoused, and in respect of the politics that he has represented and represents. If I may say so with respect, Mr. Speaker, I will say proudly that in my view, and I believe it is the view of all his government colleagues, no one in the modern era has done more for Gibraltar to remain British than Joe Bassano. Sometimes, Mr. Speaker, even in the face of the British. And I think that is the most important part of the contribution that Joe Bassano has brought to the modern history of Gibraltar. In our view, therefore, Mr. Speaker, my Majesty could have chosen no better night to continue to guard against any erosion of her unhindered dominion over British Gibraltar. But I do think, Mr. Speaker, that Sir George O'Connor will be no silent knight. I don't expect that he is going to keep his view to himself now that he has been mounted in a way that others might think was more appropriate. I think this vindication, this recognition, is simply going to spur him on to do more, and that is exactly the effect that both of us who believe in him would want it to see. Mr. Speaker, I think has still got a lot to do. He represents a part of the past modern history of Gibraltar, he represents the present, and I think he also represents a huge part of the future. And he needs it when anybody gets up and says something nice about him. Imagine how much he must be hating the fact that we're all saying things about the fact that he has been honored by Her Majesty herself. It must be embarrassing indeed to be murdered in your own presence, but it is a sign of his longevity that he is lauded, whereas he is still a member of the Parliament and still very active for recognition of what he still has to contribute. And Speaker, I say to the House today that the government will, at the appropriate time, be moving a motion to be filled with the support, I hope, of the whole House. The freedom of the city of Gibraltar on the go, also now that Her Majesty has recognised his contribution as well. We think on behalf of the House it's important that the recognition of the people of Gibraltar and the way that the people of Gibraltar bestow that recognition also be considered. Now, I suppose we'll have to declare a conflict of interest and not vote on that motion, but it will be the best way of reflecting the requited love of the people of the Rock who he loves us so much. And Peter, he is full of us an inspiration and a master. Speaker, maybe on this side of the House echo the sentiments expressed by Mr. Speaker and the Honourable Chief Minister, and congratulate the Bill and indeed Lady Bassano and his extended family for this great honour that has been bestowed on the Bill. The Chief Minister has set out the background to the honour insofar as the Bill's commitment and the Father House commitment to Gibraltar, and unquestionably 45 years of politics is certainly an unquestionable commitment to Gibraltar, despite where we sit on this side of the House. There are many areas on which there has been disagreement over many, many years between Sir Joe and his opposite members on this side of the House and when he was sat on this side of the House. But clearly, that is not for today. Today is to warmly congratulate and genuinely congratulate Sir Joe on his honour, and also to remind our community of the work that he did together with others in relation to our transition from an energy-based economy to part of what it is today, together with others that were led after him. It is also true that we are reminded of his effort and his work in relation to charity. And most importantly for me, in fact, is that most members in this House, of course, are beneficiaries of the mandatory scholarship and the work that the Joe has done in relation to education and the development of opportunity for young people in our jurisdiction. And I think many in this community, if not all of us, would have been the beneficiaries of that, owe him a great debt insofar as the work he has done to develop opportunity for young people. And although we may disagree moving forward, and I think Mr. Joe and I have had various debates on the question of how we increase opportunity and offer better opportunity to those in our community moving forward, it is right to recognise the hard work that Sir Joe has done in relation to mandatory scholarships. And together, of course, in creating a nation of home owners, which I think is, again, an achievement that we should really be recognised for. What we say in this House is that, as I say in this House, that we warmly congratulate him on his on this great honour, and that's a lady behind.
To congratulate my friend and colleague, Sir George Bassano, on the award of the Sir Joe by Her Majesty the Queen. As I was registered from 1972 until 2018, having the confidence of the electorate and one of your fellow countrymen in election after election and being elected to the Parliament and to the House of Assembly for such a long period of time is a record for the victor. And it is 45 years is the longest period of time of anybody being elected to any of our institutions. That is a truly remarkable achievement. And I think what once that the girl has always shown that it takes positions and has taken positions on principle and not on their popularity. And that has continued throughout the years and it continues indeed to this day. And the analysis I recall made at the time of the Brussels Agreement or the Lisbon Agreement at a time when people were taking different views on it had been borne out in the fullness of time. And it would have been shown that the analysis that we made after the agreement of Brussels was actually the correct analysis, and these views are now widely shared by everyone, even by those who opposed to go with an opinion at that moment in time. The 1965 started with the pro-integration movement, and since those days until today, I think Joe is still a revolutionary apart. Somebody who has never thought on this for himself, and the public schools, as the Christian Minister has already said, this very close to the congratulations, uncomfortable and inviting. The reality is that he deserves nothing less. He has been an ardent exponent of the libertarian identity. He's contributed to its development significantly. The establishment of national goals in the early 1990s, in defense of the voter at the United Nations, all that adds to the record that he has created in defending the community locally, and abroad in advocating our right to self-determination and our equal determination to reject the Spanish win. So it is, Mr. Speaker, a very well deserved honor. It's an honor for him, for the duels, for the fight, and indeed for our country as a whole.
Honorable Daniel Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to be able to rise and to add my own voice to the voice of the Chief Minister, Deputy Chief Minister, and the Leader of the Opposition, congratulating Sir Joe, and also Lady Rose, on what is, by any measure, in my view, a well-deserved and indeed a belated honour that should have been bestowed on the Honourable Gentleman a long, long time ago. It's a great privilege, and also it's a great honour to represent this community, and also to do what he has done, which is to lead this community for 8 years in what has been a career spanning 45 years. But it also is phenomenally difficult as well to be a leader of this community, and indeed to represent this community, even though it is a great privilege. The size of Gibraltar, the closeness with the electorate, it brings with it dynamics that makes it at times very difficult indeed. And there is one quality which the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister alluded to, which I have always admired in the Honourable Gentleman, and that is that he makes and he also defines decisions. However unpopular those decisions may be, but he takes them as a principle. And in my view, that is something that our electorate expects out of its politicians. It's something that our electorate respects in its politicians, and we don't have to agree with the decisions that people take, but you do respect the fact that people do make, as the Honourable Gentleman does, decisions as a principle. As he knows, because he knows even though that I am one of the fallen, that I came to Gibraltar in order to follow him. He knows that. It did not work out, but that is the reality of the situation. I spent the last 17 years opposing him, but I did come back in order to follow him. And there are two principles that he has always adhered to, that I have in my own political career, and indeed as leader of the opposition, sought to weave into my own political discourse out of conviction.
and that means taking the resolution to be resolute in the defense of our homeland. But secondly, that in order to be resolute in defense of our homeland in the long run, that we must also be able, in a community like Gibraltar, to be able to say no to people when that is justified, to live within your means, to make sure that you save the future generations, and to make sure that you have an overriding duty to protect the standard of living, not only for working class people and indeed for everybody in Gibraltar today, but also tomorrow too. And that part of that Gibraltarian way of life that you are protecting is also protection against outside pressure and Spain from the United Kingdom, and it is terribly important that we live within our means, that we are always have sight of those kinds of issues, because they are, in my respect of view, and I've always understood it, that is also his discourse, inexplicably wound up. I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that although that I have spent 17 years opposing the honourable gentleman, I am proud that my family has always and will always be linked with the honourable gentleman and stood shoulder to shoulder with him right up to the end of the 1990s when my father resigned from politics. And I have absolutely no hesitation in adding my voice to congratulate the honourable gentleman.
Mr. Speaker, I rise from this corner rise to congratulate the honourable gentleman. We haven't always agreed on that, but I suppose maybe we can agree on the fact, coming from a political family, that politics takes its toll on the family as much as on the politician himself or herself. So I take this opportunity to wish congratulations to Sir Joyce and his entire family on this night. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, I think it is the very first time ever that I stand in this house to congratulate and speak on the merits of a particular person. And I think that it is in the character of the day that it should be a living legend today in our politics. I remember, Mr. Speaker, sometimes when in 1987 the press was asked as to who our party should vote. And every single person in that class, and there are other persons in this building today who are also part of that class, who held up their hands to say they would be voting for Joe and his team. And it is incontrovertible, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar underwent a transformation during those 8 years in terms of the mandatory grant where students who wanted to go to university and who may not have obtained the aid. Nonetheless, right, I thought that was transformative. I think the fact that there was so much determination and co-ownership and affordable homes built for the community, that was transformative, Mr. Speaker. And also, of course, as has been mentioned, the tenacious defense of people's interests abroad, in foreign affairs, very few people would also doubt that Joe was also transformative and fearless in the way that he defended Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, Sir Joe, for me, has always been an inspiration and certainly a guiding light. I don't think I've ever told him this, but I, in fact, was drawn to politics when I was in St. Anne's because of his program, because of his politics. Every day he has served as a true inspiration for me. He always has time, he always has time for me to provide guidance and to provide advice. He has been a tireless and fearless promoter, I think, of all of us on this side of the house, always ready to help, always ready to present advice, always ready to be painfully honest when required. And, Mr. Speaker, from the bottom of my heart, I wish to sincerely thank Sir Joe and Lady Ray, and I think that it is most certainly a most well deserved, richly deserved honor. I could think of no one better than to be knighted than Sir David Fenn.
Mr. Speaker, from the other corner of the House, I would like to congratulate Sir Joseph Fano, his family, and anybody who supports the last 45 years in which he has been serving this community. For my part, I've served this community for just 2 years, knowing what it entails. The experience that Sir Joe has had over the last 40 years is admirable, and I congratulate him. Thank you very much.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour and pleasure of serving with the Honourable Sir Joe Rossano when he was Chief Minister, and I was the General Manager of St. Dennis Hospital at the time. And we achieved great things then. I also had the honour and pleasure of working with Lady Rose Rossano when she was a union representative, and we developed an excellent working relationship and took the health service very far and completely converted the old health service at the time, back in the late 80s, and gave it another boost of life, which we then took on again when we were elected more recently. Apart from that, Mr. Speaker, I don't know whether other people are aware, but it was in the government of Sir Joe Rossano that the first Minister for the Environment and the first Ministry of the Environment was created. It was during his time and because of his vision and his commitment to the environment that the Botanic Gardens were created, that the Nature Reserve was created, that nature conservation legislation was created, so that Sir Joe Rossano had a profound effect on my own life personally, and I owe him much of my development since then, but also to the environment and the governance of environment in Jamaica. I'm not going to repeat everything that has already been said that I totally agree with, but I thought I had to add my own personal congratulations. We go back a long, long time. And I never thought at the time where I would have the honor and pleasure of serving with him as a minister in the government. So my own personal congratulations to Sir Joe, Lady Rose, and all the family who I know very well.
Mr. Speaker, I too wish to add my congratulations to Sir Joe, because, Mr. Speaker, I think I have known Sir Joe since the day I was born. Because, Mr. Speaker, I was born in the same year as Sir Joe founded the GSOC, and I am a third generation member of the party that he created. And it is therefore no surprise, Mr. Speaker, as to why all my life I have looked up to Sir Joe Rossano, particularly because of the big socialist principles that he has enshrined throughout his life and in Gibraltar. Mr. Speaker, I have to have a particular gratitude to Sir Joe because, Mr. Speaker, I am one of those in a generation of Gibraltar that we have to be particularly grateful to the visionary policies that were introduced in the late 80s and the early 90s, such as the grants that were given to students, Mr. Speaker. And I and people of my generation are examples of the success of the policies of Sir Joe Rossano's government at the time. Mr. Speaker, we all know that Sir Joe's principles and steadfast ideas are unquestionable, and it is always about having Gibraltar and the best for Gibraltar and Gibraltar's citizens in his heart. I frequently refer to Sir Joe as my role model and as a legend, and I know he hates it when I say it, but it's true, Mr. Speaker, and you can't help but feel like that with someone who has been a very close family friend all my life. And I therefore wish to also extend congratulations to Sir Joe, to Lady Rose, and all of the family.
For the sake of accuracy of answer, I should have said that the Honourable Commander for the Winter will I witness him. Mr. Speaker, the bill is probably having a worst time in Parliament in 45 years, if that's the word. But I do it absolutely right and proper that we should be honoring our thoughts on an individual whose contribution to the work of the Chief Minister, as I said before, I think is unprecedented. It's impossible in the time that we have today to begin to list each of the things that he's been involved in, whether it's in defense of our community, whether it's in relation to our health services, our housing, our education, our business community, and indeed our economy. Because in each of those areas that I mentioned, his contribution and work that he did between 88 and 96 is absolutely critical and crucial to the success that we enjoy today. Because what he did in those years was do what was joked by members on the other side of the House as earlier, so Jordan Connors was living in economic miracle. The truth is, he actually did it. Because what he did in those 8 years, in the transformation from the NOD to a private sector based economy, was an absolute economic miracle. And the success that we've enjoyed since then can be traced and tracked very simply back to the work that was done in that time. And a few of the speakers today have talked about his vision. And I think that's absolutely right. When you rewind the clock to 1990, and you imagined a stateless chief business officer engaging with a professional accounting firm, like KPMG, I think it was at the time, who was instructed by the chief business at the time to do a review of our entire financial services product line, to see how it could be improved, to see how it could be adapted, and made more fit for purpose at the time, the first and only time it's ever happened. And those same products today are still being used by our professionals every day of the week. That's not the sort of vision that today is brought to Gibraltar and to this Parliament, and that is what should be important. But there's another side to the man, which we all know, and love. Every single time that today is put an election in Gibraltar in the 45 years that he's been, whatever the result, the day after the election, he has gone back to thank the people in all the states who voted for him. And you would say, that's part of politics. Could be. But to do it every time you've left an election, to say, go back to the people and thank you for trusting me with a vote, is something that I have never, ever seen before, and I'm delighted that this party, and our current Chief Minister, Tanya, is continuing with that program and thanking people for their support the morning after and the existing night when people have voted for you at the election. And that tells you a little bit about the principles-based individual that Sir Joe is and has led by example for all these years of service. Mr. Speaker, when I heard the news of the appointment, I was absolutely overjoyed. And what struck me most was that many of my friends who haven't voted for him every time in a single election like I have, especially was, they too were delighted. It was even better recognized. The contribution, not just to Gibraltar, but its structure, its fundamental basis of success in its economy, is down to the jail. And even though those who haven't voted for him, still agree that this honor is necessary and very, very richly deserved. I had the benefit of working with Bill within this party since 1987-88, but of course, as a young child, when the girl would come home to my house in Berlin, the days of the AWDP, I had the pleasure as a younger child of having spent many, many fantastic hours listening and learning from this wonderful Gibraltarian. So it's a huge pleasure that I congratulate the girl and Lady Rose and the family on a manner that is absolutely deserved, and I'm delighted to be a part of the Parliament that is here to be with them. Thank you. The Honourable Bill Rummer. Mr. Speaker, I can't believe people are not concluded, and therefore also I wish to associate myself with the comments made here today. I have had the privilege of sitting at the left hand of this man, the father of the house, for 6 years. Now, giving me also a great opportunity to share time with him and to discuss matters that I sat beside him. A man who loves him or not, agree with him or not, you cannot fail to recognize what he has done for the daughter and its people. His beliefs and actions have been purely chosen by what he in his mind he felt respectful to both us and his people, and he was stood by this regardless, as a man of principle. I have many things to thank Sir Joe for, not least his work on government and the government's mandatory courses football all, which allowed me to gain an education and countless others in Gibraltar. His addictive attraction to the youth and his work with them is something quite remarkable and special. I see countless young people run up to him to greet him and I think he shout out his name, Joe, Joe. And I've been present when it happened, and you can see the immense pride within him every time that happens. So yesterday, I was given a photo of him taken at this year's New Year's Bash, standing with my eldest daughter, the same daughter who clung to him just a few years ago while thinking that he was Father Christmas. That is not Father Christmas himself. She was already thinking that there was something very special in him. So Joe is phenomenal with Gibraltar. I wish to congratulate him for his work and his wife, Lady Rose, for her years of support. I am sure that she would love me to say that clearly behind a great man, there is a great of women. Congratulations to Rose.
Mr. Speaker, the members of the council have already said a great deal about the facilities and virtues of the growth. I have been known and known in politics after president for the last 2 years. But I can say, Mr. Speaker, from my heart, that it will certainly be an experience and a change that will have across the floor. I certainly do learn something new each time. And I think just for that, Mr. Speaker, I thank the Joe for his contribution to politics. He said recently, I think in a further interview, that he felt that if in Gibraltar and in politics you could make a contribution, you should do so. I think, Mr. Speaker, he has certainly done so, 44 or 5 years worth of doing exactly that. And I do know he's a man of conviction, a man of principle, and I salute him for that. And I think the people of Gibraltar also salute him for that. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in honouring Sir Joe, I can say that when I returned from the UK in 87 to become a young teacher, one of the things that I did was join the union and join the GSLP. And I was a member of the GSLP for a long time. And during the times that I was in the union, one thing that I remember, I was negotiating with him and Kaja and Joe Moore. One of the things that were very, very clear to me was that if you made your case, whatever case, and you made your argument, you would be listened to and they were implemented. And I was very funny who had the basis to say, if you can justify why you get things, you will get them. And due to differences that we had, I presented myself in 96 and left my deposit, and there was a change of government. But after, in the year 2000, when the Liberal Party and the GSLP got together, one thing that we asked, Joe Garcia to say to Joe Bassano, look, I've been very much of an opposition against the GSLP in many of the cases. How do you feel now that I present myself with you? And I can tell you there was not a shadow of doubt, because Joe actually realized that I was defending the people, and that what I was doing was as a matter of principle, and that's why he used to agree with these things. After that, from the year 2000, I sat on that side in the opposition, because that's when the GSLP Liberals were in the opposition as an alliance. And I can tell you that the experience, the wise advice that I used to get from Joe Bassano in helping me draft questions, in helping me deal with the issues at the time, is immense. I couldn't have a better person helping me draft questions and get the statistics which you used to let me get from the utilities, whether the utilities were how many units things were costing all that.
but it's a learning curve. And whatever I know now about politics and whatever I know now about the House, it's thanks to the Joe. He has given me a vision, and that is why it's very easy for me to be on this side, to be serving in a government with the Joe. So Joe, thank you very much for helping me, and I think you really deserve what you got, and also maybe you very, very much like to congratulate you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Speaker, I don't want simply to continue the misery that the game has been enduring, or indeed to be the
business day for the record that I have to really go for the hammer.
Or indeed because I don't want to be the only one who has not said that I can say something in terms of congratulating Sir Joe, and indeed I do congratulate Sir Joe. In the 2 years I have now spent in this house, I have learned to appreciate a very different side to Sir Joe that I wasn't aware existed prior to entering this house, and that is a side that represents a man who dearly loves politics and also loves politicians. But whether you're with him or against him, he has a deep respect for what you do and say. That's always very evident in interactions both in this house and indeed outside of this house. So in that regard, I think the honour is wholeheartedly deserved. The surprise for me wasn't so much that the honour was extended to Sir Joe, but that he accepted. But there you go. We have so it's Sir Joe. And all your family, congratulations.
On this historic day, 18-1-18, again, I'm quoting blank, there's something that I forgot to say. And those members have mentioned the extent to which the Honourable Member was responsible for improvements in various areas of public administration. I recall how, from 1972 to 1980, with his question from that side of your position, he influenced the work of a young Minister for Labour and Social Security who adopted measures like legislation against unfair dismissal, linking the level of average of old age pensions to average earnings. There is a matter which, from what I am aware, the other lady is sitting, he urged me to adopt. I was very happy to do so, and here I am. A lot of the credit is to give him in that respect as well. I ask that by no means be, we have a great deal.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is indeed a really personal pleasure for me to be able to stand up today and round up and re-echo and re-echo the, what is it, 15, sort of congratulatory messages towards Sir Joe. Sir Joe and I don't know if you remember, when I actually first came into contact in a formal situation way back in 1973. I had just left school and was working as an extremely young civil servant at the time, and I had joined in the GPPA union. Sir Joe was considered as a walking legend already back in 1973, there were the early days of the fight for parity. And Joe Bozzano sat there in his right as a grand officer of the TGW. And certainly we all look forward, like my colleagues have said, you know, to the inspiration that Joe gave. Right? He always came across as an extremely fair person. He came across as someone who would never be afraid to call a spade a spade. And when you have to put someone in their place, he deals with a decorum and a smile that only the Joe could have done. I know he's done it in this house for the last, he's done it here for the last 45 years. And in the 10 years that I have sat in this house, and Joe and I have never come from the same side, we went even on one side or the other. But certainly I went from the way that he has encourage ministers to work, like Mr. Speaker has just said, the way that he can advise you behind the speaker's chair, and above all, his frankness and his love for devotion and all things to potato is what we always remain in my heart. Congratulations for Joe for many more years to come.
RKO, the teachers, the officers, papers to be made, for the first time, and this time, we are going to go for the time. I don't know where I've been the only in the last 45 years, I think. But I've certainly ended in the last 45 minutes. And I can understand the surprise that I've been defaulted to accept the honor, because I don't believe in honor. That is to say, I am socialist. And we socially believe that a better world can be created, one in which there is not a hierarchy. But clearly, I was wrong, because the reaction has been that I made more people happy by saying a three letter word in 5 minutes than I've done 45 years without the other things put together. Because the response to the information that came out, the news that came out in the new year has been quite astonishing, I have to say. When I read it, that those close to me could be, urging me to accept this for many years, would be happy that I have finally relented, not the rest of the people should come out. But certainly, I did not expect that almost every sister in the Volta and every person that I've known either as a friend or a foe would be so happy to see it happening. I believe it could, that it could be so, because when the whole of our community celebrates something, we do something that is the envy of the rest of the world, when we all share in something and we see that the collective good. And we see that every year in National Day, and National Day we put our differences on one side, and we are one people. And I think when we are like that about an individual, it's an individual misfortune or a misfortune, isn't it? But what is happening is a good thing. I'd like to thank everybody, members. My colleagues here, my family in the USLP, and my biological family, and everybody who has written to me or emailed or texted me, actually, in the process of answering each one individually. So this is my official sort of activity that I have to do. But I think it's two important messages that I think I would like to take this opportunity to do for the benefit of the Delta and for the benefit of my colleagues in Parliament, with responsibility to lead the people of the Delta in the problems that we face in the future, like we face in the past. I think the importance of economic self-sufficiency in our case is greater than in any other community, because we've got somebody on our doorstep who is a thousand times or several thousand times bigger than us that wants to take us over against our will. And therefore, economic strength is not just something desirable, it's something essential for our survival. We are not in a position to be able to say no to the UK, no to Spain, and no to the UN if we're not in a position to pay our way. And that is why it's so important to be prudent in the use of money and to be putting money away from the future. You know, the Henry Day Fund now has got universal acceptance. Well, it used to be derided as a joke in 1996. You know, it teaches a politician to do things that are popular with the money rather than to leave it available for somebody else to use it to make. To be popular with the money I left him, which is what happened. And that meant that, you know, you are tempted to say, well, I'm not going to make the same mistake twice. That was my advice to my colleagues who have to make the same mistake again, even if the same thing happens again in the future, because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do, and when you've got an opportunity to have more money than we need to spend, but that money should be there for the time when we will not have more money than we need to spend, and that is therefore a strength in having that money there. So it was then, the thing that has been mentioned this, but in fact, what was then the rainy day fund has now become the standard for anybody that creates a sovereign fund, because wherever the source of our revenue, there is a surplus and they don't spend the surplus. So then we're going to go back to taxpayers. They actually put it away in order to provide a safeguard. In the world in which we live, independent or our own particular problem, today, in my 45 years of experience, I have to say the level of uncertainty in the world is somewhere I've not seen before. I think the level of uncertainty on a global scale is unparalleled, and it's the first time that that level is happening since 1945, since the end of the war, when the European countries decided they should work to have a permanent peace plan, which has already been broken occasionally in different geographical spots. But what they're saying also is a reaction against the establishment almost everywhere. That doesn't mean we're not going to get to. But the way that that reaction is manifesting itself is very dangerous. Because a reaction against the establishment is a reaction that is leading to people that, instead of being people who seem to be capable of improving on the performance of the establishment, in many cases, in the case of the United States, you know, there is now a scenario that the most powerful nation in the world is being led in a direction which changes almost on an hourly basis, from Monday to night. And we cannot escape what happens in the world. The nature of the global economy is such that every day that globalization is reaching deeper and deeper into every corner of life. We have to position ourselves wherever the future is going to be. The essence of success is to make a judgment, an intelligent judgment based on a logical analysis of where the world is going to be in 8 years, and be there when that happens, and be ahead of the world. And that is part of the responsibility you have in government. That sometimes makes it difficult for the people in your position who may not understand where it is that you're heading for in what you're doing today. But again, in the case of Gibraltar, we have to do it on the basis that there is somebody a few years away from us that doesn't want us to succeed. And therefore, planning for success requires us to do it so that, when things are dried and sound is when we then can have the luxury of making the public, because otherwise they may never happen. I believe that one of the most important things that has happened since the entire process of the attempted handover of the vote to Spain, which is what we've been subjected to in this parliament almost since 1976, certainly it wasn't as clear in 1972, but it became very clear post 1975. But already in 1972, I think the transition was being seen in Spain. The days of the dictatorship were numbered, and the position in the United Kingdom was changing. Is not in the political sphere, in the people in Whitehall, but a Spain that had a democratic government should receive greater reception to its aspirations over Gibraltar than a dictatorship has. As far as we are concerned, in Gibraltar, whether there is, I also need to say, if there were to be a socialist republic in Spain and whether a conservative government in the United Kingdom, I don't know about where I would want to be as a socialist with a conservative government in London and not with a socialist government in Spain. Government change. You cannot put the destiny of a country and its people simply because a particular government be there at a particular point in time, because you don't know. We've seen how the thing in the Cordial Agreement that the previous government generally believed could not be fair to pick. They didn't just pick a cherry, they took the whole tree when they came in.
And therefore we know that we would not want to learn from those lessons when we take decisions for the future. But for me, there are some very important things about the situation we have today, and one of the most important is that we've got a situation where we agree on both sides of the house of the need to be prudential in the use of money and put money away for the future. The revenue based fund is now a position that members of both sides take as well as we do, and that's important for the security of our country. We both agree that there is no future in the bilateral budget process, which for many years only the DSLT was the entity that attacked budget, while now other people were defending it. And I know that you know, the position of the AACI was not one that was particularly popular within the AACI, but one that the leadership of the AACI at the time felt that it was accepted publicly, you know. The best that could be obtained in the circumstances was what was agreed in Brussels, and the same year was true of the IFB, which is now being revised again by Spain. So, you know, we are now back with Spain thinking that we have the upper hand, as we have heard so many other times in our history. And it's up to us, not just the government, but we, the 17 representatives of the people of the Delta, is up to us to make sure that we fight shoulder to shoulder to defeat Spanish aspirations of the Delta. And of course, as I am the vice commander of the team, I would expect everyone and the government of the side to do their duty.
After all 17 communications from the chair, we can move on. Papers to be made the table between
services. Mr. Speaker, can I thank you on behalf of the whole House for your indulgence in respect to communications from the chair? And I was present probably the first time in the history of his presence in this House that Robert Obama comes to a parliament where the opposition come to tell him and not to obey him. And can I beg your forgiveness for the disclosure by your request that in 1987 there was a plot at St. Anne's School to vote for Joe Bassano and not for Joe Bassano? And to take a look at the things that Paul Ryan from the right hand of the father would be honored to lay on the table with the speaker the consolidated fund supplementary funding statement number 1 in 2015-2016. The consolidated fund reallocation statement number 2 for 2015-2016, the improvement of the settlement fund reallocation statement number 1 of 2015-2016, and the annual report of the Gibraltar Police Authority for the year end of 31st of March 2017. Over to you.
We are going to answer to all questions. We commence with question number 1 of 2019, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker,
can the government advise if there have been any tangible outcomes from the 4-day Chinese trade mission to Gibraltar in November 2017?
And for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications and GST. Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, and would the Honourable Minister care to tell the House any of those what the tangible outcomes might be? Were there any inward investments or any particular business lines that the government are looking to develop as a challenge?
Mr. Speaker,
I think the Ministry is not willing to tell the House any of the tangible outcomes. May I ask perhaps if you could tell the House who paid for the visit?
Mr.
for the speaker. I'm not prepared to say any tangible outcome because, in fact, following his advice, which is also my view, that we should not make an action until we are signed, sealed, and ready to be delivered. That is what he said we should do, and that is what I'm doing, or what I would have done even if we had not advised him. The visit was funded by the embassy in London, except for what was provided here in terms of receptions or the accommodation and the family. They paid that on first to the and we looked after them while they were here. This is a normal thing that happens in situations like this. I can tell him that I will be staying a day in London in our visit next week. And I can tell him that I will be having meetings in London with both the China Development Bank and the Bank of China. So let's see what something is happening. Question number two, the album I'm thinking. And if you think of Hamble, don't please provide the total growth debt with the debt of that personal thinking from the first step. The world will not get to the public debt for the foreign debt for the 1st of October 2017.
I'm for the Organization for Economic Development, Telecommunications, and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 3 to 5.
Question number 3, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can we get on to the total liquid reserve figure on its constituents, namely consolidated funds, improvements in government funds, government-owned companies, deposits, contingencies, and other funds, considering that being the 1st of October 2017?
Question number 4, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
And if the Speaker can be done, please advise my total liquid reserve and investors held, given details of their bank savings, bank accounts, and cash held, considering the date being the 1st of October 2017.
Question number 5, the Honourable Alan Clinton.
Mr. Speaker, can we get into the balance on the general thinking fund at the 1st of October 2017?
I'm for the head of the Ministry of Economic Development, Telecommunications, and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, the position as regards the total liquid asset composition, when, where, and how these are invested on a particular date chosen by the member of the group, continues to be a strategic statement. The figures requested for the 1st of October are gross debt, $447.7 million, general thinking fund, $5.2 million, aggregate debt, $442.5 million, cash, $150.4 million, net debt, $292,100,000.
Question number 6, the window of the
Mr. Speaker, what is the government's policy in relation to supply workers who have been travelling base and post for over 12 months within the civil service, government-owned companies or agencies, and have to take themselves after 6 months maternity leave?
I am for the Organisation for Economic Development, Telecommunications, and the GST.
Speaker, I will answer this question number 7.
Question number 7, the Honourable Alex
Yellow. Speaker, can the government provide a schedule as of the 8th of January 2018 relating to supply workers within the civil service, government-owned companies and agencies detailing A, the department's company agency the workers providing services for, B, the grade of the position the supply worker is covering, C, the reasons for which the cover is required, and D, since when the supply worker has been providing services to a civil service agency or company?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for Economic Development, Telecommunications, and the GST.
Mr. Speaker, it is not possible to provide the information for the date required in the time scale of the question. If the honourable member who puts the question for the next meeting, it will be answered. As regards persons employed by private sector companies and who provide relief cover, they are employed on private sector pay and conditions of employment. It is not therefore a matter of government policy, but of statutory provision.
I understand fully that obviously the employee, the supply workers are employed directly by private sector companies and assess the conditions and rates of employment are such. However, when a person is covering a vacant post in the civil service over 12 years or 12 months, old, they can also acquire rights towards that post or to another vacancy, which may arise within the civil service. And therefore, does the government see that perhaps there is a case of discrimination where women who are covering for these vacant posts are then having to leave to take 3-6 months of maternity leave, but then when they return from the maternity leave, they go back obviously to a private company and they lose out on that right which they acquire, and perhaps they might be sent to another company or agency where the right is lost. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, would it not be possible for the government to look into this policy? Because I believe that there is a case for discrimination. Because obviously, men do not have to have babies, and the vacant post continues. So it's only a demographic of women who have to go and exercise their right of maternity leave.
Well, I'm not sure that the honourable member is saying that it has happened to somebody or that it is capable of happening to somebody. But I'm certainly not aware that it has happened to anybody. And I'm certainly prepared to have a look at the claim that it made. I thought it was referring to the nature of the entitlement that exists among the workers. But certainly I'm not aware that anybody was deprived of the opportunity of applying for a vacancy on the basis that they were back in doing supply work, but there had been an interruption in the period because of their maternity cover. If it happens, then I think it's got a point that is then merits examination, but we'll see if it really is happening or not. I don't think we would take a policy decision on something that is not happening and it won't happen just because it might.
From a procedural point of view, I advise the other member there are two things to listen to. So can I write to the honourable minister, say, can I have information in February? Or, for the February meeting, you can give notice of the question straight away. But for the February meeting.
Question number 8, the honourable agent's name. This is Peter Fowler. Further to the answer provided to question W194 of 2017, can the notice of the court update the post in respect of the grade 9, that is the notice of assistance post, which was or is vacant within the growth of sports and leisure authority? Thank you, the Honourable Minister for Culture and Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, the rate of grade 9 administrative assistance will be advertised shortly, after which the standard recruitment and selection process will be undertaken.
Mr. Speaker, may I have this question? I'm going to give this as a follow-up to a written question last time, where the Minister in his written answer said that there was one big complaint of rate 9, which we have now heard that it is to be overcome shortly.
Is it also where can you confirm that, that this is the only pending vacancy at the moment, or has there been any changes?
Mr. Speaker, after the extensive review that we've had in the GFLA, which I've explained in this house before to the honourable member, this is the last post in the managerial side of the GFLA. As the honourable member knows, there are admin, and then there are the SLA, the centre managers, and all those other posts. But in the case of the management, this is the last post to be allocated.
Can the minister of the sports inform this house as to how many cancellations have been necessary as any of the votes of sports and leisure facilities, indoor facilities, since September 2017, indicating the location, date, and reason for the cancellation?
Thank you, the minister of culture, the media, youth, and sport.
Speaker, the second ceremony hall was closed for the Christmas and New Year events on the 19th of December 2017 to the 3rd of January 2018. The impact of sports use was minimal due to the normal diminished use because of the festive period, and training allocations were not requested. Additionally, the Victoria Sports Hall had been closed on Tuesday, the 9th of January 2018. After 3:30 p.m. due to water injury.
And Mr. Speaker, in my question of the vote of state and local authorities in their facilities, I took it that within that the 25-meter pool or the pool for the learning of swimming and so on have been included. Can the minister confirm that those have not required any closures at all?
Mr. Speaker, I do not have that information actually, but I will ask for him if the pool was closed. I guess that in the question, when you say in what facilities, I think they've taken as the authority office. In this case, but I will check for
him. I'm satisfied, Mr. Speaker, the minister is going to check on if he has anything in the material question. He is able to present the given question of Parliament so much because of his running remains in hand. I appreciate it.
Mr. Speaker, just to say that I will be communicating with the CEO straight away after at least the exchange we are having now to find out whether that is the answer also includes. I mean, that there was no closure of the pool.
Question number 10, the other EJ Hale.
Can the Minister of Sports say whether the qualifying criteria in order to be able to obtain a fixed booking allocation valid for the whole season in respect to facilities falling under the auspices of the Sports and Sports and Leisure Authority?
To the end of the culture, the media, youth, and sport.
Mr. Speaker, fixed bookings or allocations in respect of facilities are only offered to those governing bodies of sport who are registered with the Board of Sport and Leisure Authority. In addition, regulated and registered commercial entities, i.e., aerobic classes, are also allocated slots for the whole season on a rental basis.
We're going to question 12, the honourable LSLS.
Mr. Speaker, can the government explain the change in policy for usage of the garrison of the gymnasium, given the facility is being used by not the whole of the sporting community?
Thank you, the honourable LSLS for culture, the media, and youth and sport.
Mr. Speaker, there has not been any change in policy regarding the usage of the garrison of the gymnasium. No GFLA facility is used by the whole of the sporting community.
In the last session, I asked about our patients who died in June and the month. This time now, was December last year in 2016, the Honourable Minister did say that the guys in June would undertake a refurbishment, which would enable the use for the sporting community. However, it seems that the guys in June is back up and running, but no allocations have been made. And at the same time, we don't have any allocations or identification of who the premises is being exclusively used by, as you go as the minister able to confirm what the situation is.
This is Peter, the situation is exactly the same as I said when this question was last posed. This is the Dyson Gymnasium, it's still under the auspices of the GSLA. The GSLA will give allocations to the general, and that's why I said it's not used by the whole of the sporting community. I mean, the honorable member expects that every single sport is going to be used in the gym. The gym will be used by those sports who might not have allocations elsewhere. There might be two sports that you need in the Dyson gym, as opposed to the whole of the community or the whole of the sporting fraternity. What I am telling you, Mr. Speaker, is that the gym itself, allocations has been the case. The GSLA will be, because of the refurbishment, the allocations haven't yet been given. But once the refurbishment is finished, allocations will be given to those folks who will be able to use the gym.
Yes, I think I understand that, but the allocations, if you speak another word, then saying that the allocations would be available to those who fall under the criteria that you answered in question number 10. That is, as well, not only governing bodies, but also registered businesses and so on. Am I correct in deducting that as well?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I've always been the case with the GSLA. The GSLA is the one that manages the allocations of the services. So when certain governing bodies come and ask for allocation, depending on the sport, depending on the places they are allocated, a given allocation. For example, I can tell you that allocations for basketball are not anymore given in the Garrison gym, because the Garrison gym happens to be low ceiling and a long, it's not the actual size of a basketball court. Although there are baskets there. I remember playing basketball there, and it wasn't the actual size of basketball. So we had other facilities, which we then allocate to the basketball where gathered to play in the secondary hall, be it in the Victoria Sports Hall, and not in the Garrison gym. But there might be other sports that might be able to use that, and that is up to the GSLA to give those sports the allocation in the Garrison gym.
Mr. Speaker, but given that there is a stand belonging to a football club outside the gym, can the minister confirm that the gym has not been given exclusively to one football club in particular?
No, Mr. Speaker, I just said that the gym that has been given to the football club in Lincoln is just a mechanism. Maybe one of the members knows that place really well. It's just a mechanism of the premises. So the premises has a mechanism. And then there is the gym. That club, the football club, has taken over because we come to an agreement that they can use the mechanism. And that is going to refurbish the mechanism. And therefore, the mechanism they can use as their club. The rest of the gym is still for the community, and the power of the community, that the community will be able to use it.
Just to turn a moment to question 10, and the minister said that commercial entities as well as sports organizations. Now, my understanding, for example, if I give the Honourable Government an example, he'll know where I'm coming from with this particular question, which is a Tivoli Hall. At the Tivoli Hall on the 31st of December, there was an event that was
all intents and purposes, an event run by the GSOP, the young GSOP. Now, of course, where I've told, in fact, the Honourable, the father of the house, Sir Joe, provided a speech. Now, if, for example, the young GSOP would wish to undertake something similar at some point, how would that be structured? Would it be structured through a commercial entity? How much experience does that commercial entity have to have in order to be able to book something like that? Could you give us a flavor of that, please? Well, Mr. Smith, it's very simple. Every young youth, the person who is in the young youth GOV, the person, can come and approach the GSLA, and so they want to do a function there. They can then go through the process as if it was a private entity. A private entity pays for the use of the hall. The private entity is the youth pays for the use of the hall. There is a fee. And any part, because what we try to have is what we used to have with a previous administration, where you have private entities doing, for example, concerts in the mega area, the private entities making the money and taking all the profit, and the GSLA being left with a bill. And the bill is the overtime of the people that have to be there, the cleaning, any damages that are done to the place. So we are not allowing, we do not allow private entities to do events there unless they pay the fee. And the fee is to cover the cost or to the GSLA. I think it's sensible that the government doesn't have to subsidize, by the entity and use the venue, and the government subsidizing and then they take the profit. That's the idea.
Well, thank you very much. And I quite understand the rationale behind it. The confusion is arisen because, and we were debating this internally, is because the Honourable Gentleman is using a large to say commercial entities, and of course, a political party is not a commercial entity. But effectively, the answer is that it is open to private entities as long as they pay their way.
Yes, but the GCP had a very contested private entity who would serve them. So they can say the difference and say that I want to organize.
Yes,
what happens is that there's somebody who organizes it for the group of youth, and then they come as an entity and they say, well, we want to do this for the group of youth. So it's similar to what the Honourable Member just told me.
Just one small thing to speak of that. I know the Minister quite well, and I'm sure he's not trying to mislead the House or anything, but perhaps it could be misinterpreted. In referring to my facilities have been used in the past, the Minister said, and the previous administration's private entities have used the place. And it could have been deducted that the GSLA had to foot exclusively the bill for all the time and service without having to cover those expenses from the private entity. I can testify that this House was certainly during the mindset of Minister of Court. The CEO of Sports Authority did include the cost of any GSLA staff that may have had to work over and above for the fair. And if I'm wrong, then the Minister can obviously take that information. But I don't want to just accept it on a point blank basis without either of us having the real facts, having set it up on the account. But I know the salary of those money did have to come through, and I know the estimate book for the past 3 years is like that.
Well, Mr. Cooper, he's right in a sense, in the sense that what entity used to do before was leave a deposit. So any private entity that used to use the premises of the GSLA, the other CEO, so that you could have deposited just in case, and you could be owing damages. But the rest was not charged. However, the issue I had is a deposit, and I think if I remember correctly, it was in the region of £500, where the entity, the private entity, used to put up £500,
and then give back to the yesterday the premises. If there was any damages, they used to deduct the damages from the 500 pounds. But there was not a review of actual charging or the cost.
Question number 14, the element of the element.
Mr. Speaker, can the government, can the Minister for Culture confirm that all ministerial director locations over £2,000 appear on the government's website in a document entitled Government Contract 236, Government Awarded Contract over £2,000 and Ministerial Application?
This is the end of the Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that all ministerial direct allocations over £2,000 on behalf of my ministry appear on the government's website. If the Honourable Member opposite wants to write to me with any particular contract he feels has been awarded or is not listed on the website, I can investigate the matter and revert to him with further information with this respect.
There is one query, and I'll say it now. Can the Minister explain why we have not included in this list the allocation to New Angel Limited for the Ministry of all the music festivals in this document?
Mr. Speaker, because that did not go out to tender. New Angel are the agents of MTV. Yes, pardon? Mr. Speaker, we came into this house, we gave a full explanation because the question was posed before about New Angel and the relationship between New Angel MTV and its great development. New Angel number one to go back to hindsight and see that everything was explained there in relation to New Angel.
Mr. Speaker, if I recall correctly, the Minister said that he would not divulge the value of the contract due to commercial sensitivity. Is that correct?
Mr. Speaker, the only government needs to proceed to contact. The government made a public statement in a press conference that this was being directly allocated and gave the reasons why it was being directly allocated. And said, Mr. Speaker, that the amount would be reflected in the estimate as the cost of the concert, but not the detail of the amount paid to each party. And so, Mr. Speaker, I think the government has done exactly what the Honourable Gentleman has asked us, whether we have done or not. That is to say, we have disclosed any contract which has not been awarded by tender. That's the contract that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to in respect to New Angel, because it was directly allocated in the context of the statement which set that out in detail at the press conference, followed up with a question which was on the record, and the statement in this House when we've been questioned about it.
Mr. Speaker, although I agree that that is how the government presented the festival, in the past, obviously, we've been through tender. And the taxpayer has been, well, at least it was on the same document on the government website. So the taxpayer was able to compare the value of the previous organizers in comparison to what we have now. And at the moment, we're not seeing what the direct value of this concept is. And I feel that the taxpayer is not being informed of the full disclosure of this contract.
For all of the reasons that we have set out before, there are some contracts which are commercially sensitive. The only thing I want to go back and read about what we said about the music industry and the commercial sensitivity of it. But the fact that we know exactly what the music festival was, because it's set out in the estimate, and then Mr. Clinton, Mr. Clinton, and asked us to tell the House not just what the estimate has been, but what the final account is, and we provide that when it is ready, and we have a bingo myself, when it's to be ready, but when it's ready, it's provided for. So you have an estimate of cost, and then you have an actual cost. Now, the breakdown within that of each article, each organizer, etc., is not provided because it's that source of industry. It can
now the following year, if we had disclosed sensitive information the year before about an artist, about an agent, etc., etc., nobody would touch that. But the fact is exactly what it costs and what he gets, whether he or she gets, for the value that is paid. So, on an estimate of 2.5 million, you got one concert 1 year, and an estimate of 2.5 million the year later, you got a different concert the year after. So, you know what you're getting. Now, whether the Manorama costs X, or whether the Grandian costs Y, or whether the agent that organized costs X or costs Y, is not detailed that you can give. But I told the other gentleman before, at least I think I told one of them, this is not information that we'll keep from them. It's not information that we're not allowed to give publicly, and therefore, we're quite happy to, behind the speaker's chair, on the basis of confidentiality, tell them the amount, but they can't share that amount. Because this is the nature of that industry. It would be the best way of the Gibraltar Music Festival if we started to disclose what we're paying artists and what we're paying agents and what we're paying organizers. It would be in. Nobody would take us where we are. Now, assuming the Venerable Gentleman went to the government proper and deliver on his commitments, and one of the things that we were committed to do was organizing a mega concert, and now organizing a mega festival, we want to continue doing that because we think it's good, not just for taxpayers, but also for Gibraltar as a whole. In the context of the entertainment we've provided, how Gibraltar becomes a magnet for people, how international companies based in Gibraltar bring their international voice to Gibraltar around the music festival, all of them. I've said before, but I have to justify the existence of the festival to members of the public who sometimes feel as if they don't want us to continue with it. Well, we think it is a good thing for the government to continue with it, and we're not going to do things or give information which does not enable us to continue with it.
Under the guise of a question in the mind which the Honourable Member has made it, the Minister has invited him to say whether there is any instance where it has not been, the information has not been included, and he is prepared to come investigate and revert to him. I cannot allow greater information in the exercise of my discussion on the matter of the music festival, greater information of the matter that I have already done. You know, there have been a number of exchanges in the music festival, which does not arise directly out of this question. I will go to the member, I will allow him one last question, but that is it.
Mr. Speaker, I just wanted to clarify that it has nothing to do with the artist or the agent who are bringing the performers over. It's to do with the organisers that the UCC, the taxpayer, used to see what the organisers were costing the taxpayer. And that is no longer the case, and I see that obviously the commercial interests of a private company are being put over and back and about of previous organisers and the Triple Team taxpayers and the wages.
That is plainly and utterly ridiculous. How are the interests of the commercial entity being put ahead of the interests of the taxpayer if what we're doing is in the interest of the taxpayer to ensure that the taxpayer can continue to enjoy the festival at the best possible prices? But we think we don't want it to disclose it, Mr. Speaker, because it costs us more if we do that. Doesn't everything make sense if you apply a modicum of consideration if we're saying that we should not disclose it because that is how we can do this deal, Mr. Speaker? But look, Mr. Speaker, don't you buy what that we can be told what to ask us next?
Question number 14, the Honourable Alex Lally.
The Speaker, has the government considered the impact of the return of students to university and changing the date for the Gibraltar Music Festival?
Let me make it clear, abundantly clear, before the Honourable Minister answers this question, that I would only allow supplementary in respect of students, but not the members of the community.
Are you with me?
Very well. Thank you. I tell the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Media, Youth and Sport. Thank you.
The Speaker, and can the Minister confirm how many students the government expects will not be able or be able to attend the festival?
Well, Mr. Speaker, to tell you the truth, I don't know how many students would like to go to the music festival. So that question does not arise. I mean, how enough could I assume, or is it that all the students would go to UK like music?
is it that every single student that is studying in the UK are going to come to the music festival? Well, probably students who don't like music, and they're going to come to the music festival. Well, I'm saying to you, the answer to your question, which is, did we take into account? I've already given a public statement of why we chose the date. There is a reason why we chose the date. So yes, of course, when the dates were given to me, one of the things that I said, well, the other students are going to tell me myself, and I'm going to go for it. He's testing me, because I said I'm going to be 21st and 22nd, and he might be leaving the university on the 19th. But listen to Peter, these are things that you have to work around other people. I've told them that we work around with yourselves. It's to do with the dates that GFA give us. So, do I take into consideration? Of course I take into consideration. These are people that are not going to come in. Because there are 200 students that are not going to come to the music festival, it means that we're going to make 200 less money for 200 people. But look, I expect people to come from the UK on that date. Because it might be better that they come from the UK on that date. When you do events, and I can tell you that I've got a little bit of experience in doing events now, I think. And when you do events, of course, you look at whether it's the high or low season of tourism, whether the fraternity of God, for example, are going to come in March or April, which is the best time after the Premier League in Bath. Are we going to have the tournament here? All these things are taken into consideration, of course they are. But look, when it comes to, when you're tied up with the DFA, telling you, look, these are your... By the way, last year, the only member must know that on the 3rd of September, when we were all enjoying the music festival, there were about 150 people going to Cairo at the same time. Because there was a football match on the same day. And we could then dictate, because of the Italian season, because I even said, I said to the European Paris, you've got to go to Paris, because I'm doing a music festival on that day. This year, because of what we've done with the VFA, it's a completely different ballgame. I can't do it on the week that it was done last year, because I had a football match. And that's the dynamics of all these things. So, yes, of course, I said, but I said, yes, sir. There's no answer to the question. Of course, I did take into consideration students.
Question number 15, the president of MD Hassan.
Mr. Speaker, with regard to last summer's MTV calling festival, does government accept viewing figures in the UK? And if so, how do they measure up to the 1 billion global audience that they said it would reach?
Thank you, Mr. Minister for Culture, the media, youth and sport.
Mr. Speaker, the 1 billion reach figure has a specific definition in the media industry, and that it is an estimate of the total number of people who can access, i.e., see a particular TV program on MTV networks globally, as opposed to the number of people that actually watch the program. Today, the program has been broadcast in 16 countries and 5 MTV channels. Furthermore, MTV Gibraltar Calling World Stage was also broadcast last Friday, airing around another 150 countries worldwide.
Mr. Speaker, it's very easy to say access, but at the end of the day, no one cares about access unless you actually watch it. And the BARD, the Broadcasters Audience Research Board, who provide a minute-by-minute report, which I have right here, and on two of their programs, have shown that the average viewing was 0.06% access on both programs. So why can the honourable gentleman expect us to believe that simply because it's got an access to a worldwide audience that everybody watched it? when at the end of the day, the typical rate of yield was 0%, and either the honourable gentleman has misled the House, or somebody in MTV has misled the honourable gentleman about the potential of who was going to watch this program, or these programs, which both came at 0%.
Nobody has misled the House. So the House has been told is that this is the week, in other words, the number of people who can watch it. 0.6% of the UK watching population on television is more than what the year before. The revelry will have said that. So the exposure is going further. Let alone what the other gentleman has told her, which are the many other instances when the programme has been served. The other one just wants to concentrate on two occasions when the programme has been served, because of the data that she has, no doubt having read an article about the subject in the Devoted Chronicle, as we all did. Now, Mr. Speaker, if that is the case, the other gentleman and the other lady, of course, is entitled to say, on this occasion it is watched early by this number of people. Are you disappointed? Of course I'm disappointed, Mr. Speaker. I would like 100% of the UK audience available to switch off BBC One, switch off BBC Two, switch off Channel 4, ITV and Channel 5, and there's something on which is about Gibraltar and MTV. And then to those of you putting on the channels on, I would like people to switch off MTV, switch off Channel 4, ITV, BBC Two and BBC One, and just what? To both of them in the time. Because it's a plausible thing, I think we all agree when the power would be available, you can know this, what's the program about Gibraltar? Let alone when I'm an answer man, Mr. Speaker. Now, if the Gibraltar program is then going to be shown on the worldwide channel, as well as anyone has told her that it is being shown, not all of which is subject to the BARB, because one of those things stands for British, Mr. Speaker. We don't know exactly how many people have watched this program. But we know that we looked at any more people that didn't watch the program that didn't exist the year before. And we know, Mr. Speaker, that the advertisements that were thrown about the world on MTV with an audience. Now, the thing that the lady has to decide is whether she is taking the position that having the exposure is valuable, or that you only are interested in actual viewers. This is a very live issue in the world of advertising. Do you pay, Mr. Speaker, a channel based on the number of people who might watch it and the number of people who do watch it on average, or the number of people who watch the program when your advert appears? Well, Mr. Speaker, if you've ever done a contract for advertising, you have to pay based on the potential reach of the channel and its average view. And that is what the Honourable Gentleman has talked about in the past when he's been talking about views, when he's talking about the potential number of views. We're very happy that the Gibraltar program is going further. We wish it would go even further. So, perhaps as we continue in this process, we will be able to persuade more people to watch the magnificent Gibraltar Festival, music festival programs that are being produced by MTV. The reality is that this is a great advertisement for Gibraltar, it's a good thing for Gibraltar, and I do not understand why members, if I'm associated on the extremes on the other side, now seem to want to go down. That perhaps is just concerned on the list of people who are coming to the forum, and we might find them happier members of the concert viewing community.
Mr. Speaker, with respect, I think we continue to be misled. By the way, following from the Chief Minister talking about Britain and the Sun, just to get an idea, the BRB has shown that Britain and the Sun is 1.9 million viewers. Now, that is viewing. Viewing is 1.9 million, which would only have been a fraction of the 1 billion we were told, but actually, we have 7,000 people watching this. So, of course, my position is that I want to know whether Gibraltar has had the exposure that we were promised or led to believe. And saying that this is only the British association that was putting out the figures, and therefore doesn't mean much. I think actually the MTV show being Gibraltar for every season of proximity and accessibility is it was going to be watched anywhere at a peak, it was going to be in the UK. So even taking that as an average and sizing that by 30, you don't even get 230,000. So yes, I continue to think we've been misled. And I would like to ask the government if they actually agreed to nuclear entity to air the Gibraltar polling show directly or indirectly?
Let me speak that there is no question of us having paid MTV to air a show directly or indirectly, Mr. Speaker. We explained to this House what the deal with MTV was, Mr. Speaker. When we came to this House and we set out to the other lady and all members of it what the position was. But, Mr. Speaker, if 0.96% of the global audience watched, that's 600,000 people around the world watching a program about Gibraltar. If 0.96%, Mr. Speaker, I understand that 0.06% is in the UK. I just made the point to her that it was in the UK. I am extrapolating to her 0.06% of 1 billion, which is the potential global audience of channels. If we achieve 0.06%, yes, it's 600,000 people. If 7,000 of those are in the UK, then 593,000 are in the rest of the world. We might not hear about the British election. So, Mr. Speaker, are we dissatisfied that there have not been 1 billion people watching? Yes. Are we dissatisfied that 1.9 million people did not watch? Yes. Are we dissatisfied that 52 million people in the United Kingdom did not watch? Yes. Do we want more to watch? Yes. Does that mean that this is the wrong deal? Quite not the case, Mr. Speaker. The opposite. This is exactly the right deal because it's putting us in a position where we are potentially having that reach. And we're potentially more people will watch in the future. And perhaps it's to become a classic and more people will watch it again in the future. But Mr. Speaker, I don't understand the difference. Why is it that honorable members of the group, at least those at the extreme, don't appear to want us to do everything possible to advertise to go there? Unless the people with the view that if we were now doing it with a local promoter, we would be told that we should consider doing it with international promoters who might give us a potential global audience reach of up to a billion.
Mr. Speaker, advertising by all means if it's viewed and absorbed, not if you get a 0% viewing rating. Following on from the question about whether that has been confirmed that you paid on TV,
I said the evidence, because I said we did not pay MTV. We did to air the program. We did a deal which included a television program, Mr. Speaker. But the evidence.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Culture therefore confirm whether this government still believes, despite all these contradictory figures and promises, that the MTV deal is good value for taxpayers' money? Or is this actually a case of a salesman putting massive numbers to government, the government failing to conduct its own due diligence, and now finding itself in a position where it either holds a provider to account and risks political embarrassment, or carries on rolling forward as if everything is going to pass?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm on behalf of the whole government, before giving way to the Honourable Minister for Culture, the Committee of the Honourable Lady more physics, that we consider that having a potential global reach of 1 billion is very good for the Gibraltar taxpayer, that we will continue not out of a fear of political embarrassment, which will not fail, Mr. Speaker. Whether the Assembly will turn that wrong, we will be the first to tell the public that we think we've got something wrong, and we will deal with it. But that this is the right thing to do. So from the point of view of the entertainment provided, the cost at which the entertainment is provided, and the potential reach of the advertisement of this program after the entertainment has been provided, a very good deal too. I commend the Minister for Culture for having done it. I believe it is absolutely right that we continue, and I do not understand the potential motivation for Gibraltar not to make an international advertisement of a function in Gibraltar, which is a promotion of what we do in Gibraltar, but I give it before I present the Honourable Minister so that he can give her the figures he has available.
Mr. Speaker, first of all, I would like to say to the Honourable Lady that I don't know where the figure of 7,000 comes from her Mr. Speaker, she mentioned 7,000 in the BORB, which I have figures from exactly of how many people saw it. But look, if she doesn't, if she wants to go and say to the Holy Spirit, it's only 7,000 people saw it, which is wrong. No, but Mr. Speaker, if you don't understand this, you might have a program, one program, which is shown, and maybe only 7,000 people see it. But if the program is repeated and repeated, then there are other ones, how many people saw it, see it.
because there is the idea, the different ways in which people see different programs. Nowadays, you don't just sit them on the old program at 10 o'clock, where it's the camera of the TV, and see when you go to film. Then you do so, but then there are different ways of, there are different ways and means of seeing the program. I mean, it's there for people on demand to see programs. And I can tell you another lady that her figures are wrong. I just said bad figures. We're getting 62,000!
Since the introduction of speed cameras, 76 penalty notices have been rejected by the RGP for poor safety motorbikes.
Mr. Cooper, since the introduction of the speed camera pilot scheme, a total of 608 motorcyclists who are exceeding the speed limits have been found using a camera that captures the image of the rear of the motorcycle. A 7-3 cases are being perceived by the RGP from images arising from cameras that capture only the image of the front part of the motorcycle. The government expects that the introduction at the end of the pilot scheme of more cameras which capture the rear of motorcycles will result in more motorcycles
being fined for falling foul of the law. We would hope, however, that as motorcyclists see the effect of the speed cameras, their pockets, if not their consciences, will mean that less and less people offend. Finally, Mr. Speaker, the government is not aware of any model of motorcycle which has yet been developed or imported to Gibraltar which is not forward facing.
Indeed, they were. I use the terminology that the Minister himself used at the last of the Parliament, which is why I thought by describing it that way he would understand the question. He didn't actually answer the question, which is whether any had been rejected by the IGP.
That is the solution that we have in our position.
If I may just make sure I've understood it, 608 were, the question was, how many 600 notices have been rejected by the IGP? The answer is, well, 608 people have been fined, 98 further are being investigated, and therefore, I'd like to assume that zero have actually been rejected, but there's not a case of one instance where it is not possible to identify the rider or the spirit.
Mr. Speaker, do you know the gentleman, the figures for the amount of people that have been pursued? We must remember that before this power scheme was implemented, everyone who rode along that road, even in a motorcycle or in a car, would have gone past at the speed of the wish. And only in the few instances where perhaps the IGP had the roving cameras in sight, would they have been potentially, would have been potentially possible. Have caught these individuals who are obviously fighting in the law. Ever since this power scheme has come into effect, there's been a considerable decrease in the speed, and we started making it extremely a lot safer, clearly, markedly safer for not only for drivers but for pedestrians and for everyone in Gibraltar as a result of this power scheme. Remember, I'm very clear on our statement, this is a pilot scheme, and before that scheme, well, there was no control. What will happen, and what will happen in the following months, is that we will increase the amount of cameras that are throughout Gibraltar, and we will also uncap the issue from both angles, as I said, actually, that's the question. So, a power scheme is there to be looked at, is there to see, you know, how it can be improved and with other locations. It can be taken as a massive improvement to what we've had before, and this kind of extremely proud of the effect it's had on time and going traffic, making the streets safer, and also reducing the levels of pollution in terms of noise pollution, because that will mean greater noise on our road. And we will continue embarking upon this scheme, and we can safely say when we see to become a policy, because this is working, and what we will do is it makes it work even better in the future.
The question wasn't designed to pass any kind of judgment on the scheme itself. I welcome the scheme. I want it to work as well as possible. I think it's a very good and very necessary part of managing traffic on our roads. The Minister still hasn't answered the question or confirmed whether no 6 penalty notices to most motorbikes have been rejected. That's all I'm after, whether it is possible under the current scheme to, if you are riding a motorbike, whether it is possible for you to pass one of these cameras in excess of the speed limit and not to be pursued by the RPD, because it is simply impossible to identify either the bike or who is riding it. That's all I'm asking. It's quite straightforward. And the information I have indicates that certainly some, at least, are being rejected, or it's not possible to pursue every case where motorbikes have flagged up and been photographed by the camera. But if the Minister can confirm this, otherwise I'd be very happy.
And the question that's being asked is when referring to forward-facing motorbikes, which is all the gentleman which is further information can pose a more specific question on that matter, and I'm happy to be able to respond to him at those dates.
Mr. Speaker, if the Minister being deliberately obtuse, the question is about motorbikes. It's about motorbikes and whether it has been possible to find
every single one of them that has been captured on the camera, or whether they've been actively pursued. It's not about those that have been fined, it's about those that haven't been fined. This is what I said, and it hasn't answered whether any have not been able to be fined for that reason.
All the journalists are particularly obtuse and purposeful whether we all stand accused of the same thing, but we're saying it all motivates the forward facing. So the statistics the other gentleman seems to be asking us for, we find difficulty trying to identify. The real motorbikes are forward facing. And so the real motorbikes are forward facing. We're giving him the data in respect of which the prosecutions are being pursued or people have been dealt with. But we're giving him that data in respect of a pilot program. A pilot program, which the other gentleman has already told him, is being changed to include the ability to identify a vehicle from the front and the back at the same time, so that we can see who is a license plate, if it's a motorbike, which only has a license plate on the back, how to identify them in that way. So that's how the two panel works. It works by identifying the license plate. But the whole point of his question is because it shows about forward facing motorbikes. All motorbikes are forward facing, we're giving the statistics we have of what the two things are, 6,000 motorbikes, whatever it is, given in respect of such bikes.
I think the other member is entitled to receive information in the future in respect of the 98 cases that are being pursued. If some of those are rejected, then that would satisfy the minister in respect of it. But if that's the answer, we talk about any of them being rejected. If the process has not been completed, obviously the honourable minister is not in a position to give the information. But I would ask you a question. I would ask the matter to be pursued at the next meeting. If the minister has the information by then. Can we move on then?
If I just had one thing to say, yes, I agree entirely. And if it's the case that in every case where a motorbike is involved, there has either been a fine or they are currently being pursued, in other words, there are none that have been dropped entirely, then I can fully understand the minister's answer.
So I think we all agree that the question would all be with motorbikes or motorcycles.
Okay? But there may be instances where not involving a motorcycle, involving a motor vehicle of another sort, there may not be a prosecution because there may be another difficulty with a camera, which is not the identification of a number plate on the front or back of a vehicle. But the reason we're given the numbers that we have that prosecution commenced, Mr. Speaker, because if we start to look at why has a prosecution not been commenced or why has a fine not issued, there could be a myriad of issues in respect of that. There could be issues in respect of visibility of a particular state in question. There could be issues relating to the conditions of the road at the time, which might be identified and might lead people to decide that it's not appropriate to issue FPMs or any other prosecutorial mechanism in respect of that moment.
I remember having a supplementary arising from the question on the escalators. Okay, well, I think this is a convenient time for which to have a resource for 20 minutes.
Mr. Speaker, if I may, it's in relation to the question the Honourable Member asked me about the pool, and I think it's the pool and about whether we had closed down the pool and I've only got an answer to that. Mr. Speaker, just to say that on Tuesday the 10th of October 2017, the pool was closed for 1 hour due to solid fuel, and as it was at 18:25 where there was a tight swim session. Then it was on Thursday the 12th of October, the pool was closed for two-car polarization because of somebody with a diarrhea incident that occurred during the pool. On Friday the 20th of October 2017, the pool was closed at 5:35 for 30 minutes. Again for an hour of those incidents. And then the last one was on Thursday the 7th of December. The pool had to be closed due to an electrical problem that occurred in the GEO electrical meter room. The incident occurred at 7:36. The pool was closed until it was actually fixed.
A very good for them, Mr. The only one didn't catch was on the 12th of October. The 2 years of the length of time he was told. Was it the whole day? Because he never mentioned any extra time. 12th of October.
The pool was closed for 24 hours.
Question number 19, the Elbert Pier Island.
Mr. Speaker, I'm continuing on the topological theme. How many samples of bird species have been sent to the DNA testing since the 1st of December? Have any results yet been received and have any fines been issued under this scheme?
I'm for the end of the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, 25 samples have been collected since the 1st of September. One positive result has been received and one fine issued under the scheme today. I need to qualify that, Mr. Speaker, that I have two positive results that they were from the same dog. So the view was taken that being the first one, only one fine would be issued. And I'm informed only today that another batch of results has come in and there appear to be a number of matches where two, so they will be posted and fines issued.
And Mr. Speaker, does the Minister think that the paper collection may increase as we get more habituated to this paper? Bearing in mind 25 collections since the 1st of September doesn't represent a very large number.
Okay, the point is that as we first began to see, there were quite a number of non-matches, which means that the dog had not been registered. Obviously, it's clear if you have your dog registered and you're law-abiding, you're not usually going to let your dog deposit pieces in the street because you know you're going to get caught. But if you haven't bothered to register your dog, then you're going to take the risk. What we have now done is that we have changed the emphasis over the last couple of months to challenging people with dogs and asking for evidence of registration. And we are doing it in a conciliatory way and warning people that they have to do it. And we have been able to entice a number of people who have not registered the dog to do so. We will certainly set that up and then we will be issuing fines to anybody who hasn't followed the legal procedure. So the emphasis changed from collecting the people to identifying those who were breaking the law by not having registered. And hopefully that will then sort itself out.
Mr. Speaker, I certainly welcome the Minister's words in that respect. Clearly, if people aren't registering their dogs, it's impossible to find them. Will the Minister be just making it known to a public campaign of some description to warn people that this is happening and you better register very quickly because otherwise fines will be issued?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. The other member recalled that we introduced this to Green in January last year, and we gave a period of grace of about 3 months, and we intend to do the same, and by the middle of March, we will then change the trip almost, and issue the necessary press comments and so on to encourage people to make sure that their dogs are properly registered, and then we will continue. And enhance the number of samples collected. Hopefully, the time will come when there's nothing to collect. But sadly, I don't think that will actually happen.
Question number 20, the Overton Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, does government intend to privatise the lifeguard services at the beaches? And if so, will the contract go to tender?
Question the Overton, the Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The figure of government is exploring options to improve the service offered to the public. No final decisions have been taken.
Question number 21, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Can government confirm that the Upper Rock Glass Walkway has been completed, and if so, when it was completed and why it was not yet opened?
I see the owner of the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I would answer this question together with question 22.
Question number 22, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Does government intend to charge for access to the grass walkway on the Upper Rock?
I see the owner of the Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, although the final report was completed last year, as I think I said before in this house, additional work along Douglas Park had to be carried out since then. These works are nearly complete, and the department is now finalizing the management aspects of the assessment ahead of the official opening. The government is considering whether to introduce a separate charge for access to the glass walkway.
I didn't quite catch the phrase I used to use, but it sort of sounded like management speak in terms of finalising. Is it finalising who will manage the skywalk that you refer to?
Mr. Speaker, what I said is that the work, it was realised that work, that the attraction would increase the footfall around Douglas Park, and therefore that some work had to be carried to make that safer, which is what's being done now. And when I said that we were considering whether there will be a separate charge for access to the walkway or whether it will be included within the general upper access.
Between those two points you made a further point about the management of the walkway.
Yes, sir. The management aspect of the attraction, as to how it's going to be run, it's related to whether there would be a separate charge, and therefore you would have to raise the fee there. That's the sort of thing that we're considering.
So, Mr. Minister, confirm which department will be responsible for the funding?
The department responsible for all the stipend that are up now is currently the Department of the Environment and Heritage.
Question number 23, the Honourable Ian Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, when does government intend to publish the final version of the Gibraltar Nature Reserve Management Plan on its website?
I shall be able to listen to the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will publish the final version of the Gibraltar Nature Reserve Management Plan on its website. There's a draft version already there, just for clarification. As soon as it is ready to do so, it's currently not possible to give a firm date, given that the plan forms part of a wider and ongoing management review.
Does the Minister envisage the plan being changed substantially after the consultation process?
Not changed, Mr. Speaker, but expanded, given that the Department of Environment and Heritage now and Climate Change now is responsible for the site, which was not the case when the plan was produced. There's been a change in the way that we run the different attractions, and we're trying to marry the two and come up with a product that will be beneficial both for residents and tourists. And that is the process that. So the actual management aspects and the draft are not expected to change in themselves, but the limit will widen to other areas.
So one final question, because I know I'm not going to have time to send one to but it could be two in the same place, so you cannot provide one. But are we talking about the second half of this calendar year, or just have a rough idea when they would come back with another question?
Certainly in this calendar year. I suspect that we may be making announcements around the summer with a view to implementing the open by the Service Loan Commission.
Question number 24 of the Albert P. L. Hammond.
We're going to work conducted during 2017, and forgive me if I pronounced it wrong, the removal of the invasive species called Menso Floribunda from the Upper Rock Nature Reserve, and where did that work take place?
I said the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 25.
Question number 25, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, given work conducted in 2017 for the removal of a cancer plant from the Upper Rock Nature Reserve, and where did that work take place?
I answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, cancer plants from different locations within the Upper Rock were removed, notably sideways, deep days, along the North Road and Willis's Road. The Lancaster Road were also removed from the road sides near St. Michael's Place, St. Michael's Firebreak, Interspan, and Kirby Battery.
Question number 26, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, when the government published the 2016 Thinking Green Digest, and will it contain data for air pollution?
I answer the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the 2016 Thinking Green Digest is available online already from the Devoted Government website and their publications in the Environment section. Data concerning air pollution are included within the 2016 Statistics Digest, which is the partner publication, which is also available online.
Question number 27, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say the Thinking Green Underwater Camera is currently working, and how often was it unserviceable during 2017, and what were the maintenance and repair costs for 2017?
I think the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the Thinking Green Underwater Camera is presently offline since it has been serviced by the department's diving team. It should be back online before the end of the month. The camera has not been unserviceable in 2017. It has, however, been offline on several occasions for a variety of reasons unrelated to unserviceability, such as internet connectivity problems. There were no maintenance and repair costs during 2017, since this was carried out internally by officials from the Department of the Environment, Heritage and Climate Change as part of their routine duties.
Question number 28, the Honourable T.M. Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, does government agree with and adhere to the principles set out in the Environment Charter 2006, which remains on the government website but has not been renewed and so remains with the former Chief Minister and the former Minister for Environment and Signatory?
I am the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the government not only agrees and adheres to the principles set out in the Charter, we have implemented it and enshrined it into government policy, which the GSC was founded failed to do. To us, it's not a total exercise, as it clearly was for the GSC. This administration has made it a reality in the working practices of the public sector.
So on that basis, Mr. Speaker, would the Minister consider actually putting the bonus in from the Chief Minister's office just to complete the exercise, if you like?
Mr. Speaker, it isn't necessary because this is signed by a Chief Minister and a Minister for the Environment, and therefore it is, we consider it still valid. Mr. Speaker, I think I'm certainly going to put my signature on a document which will be much, much more expensive than this, and then this one will almost become irrelevant.
Question number 29, the Honourable Neil Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, the samples taken prior to the recent working out of the tunnels access via the Europa 4 tunnel, both before the activity took place and subsequent to it.
For the Honourable Minister for Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 30 and 31.
Question number 30, the Honourable T.L. Hammond.
With an environmental impact assessment conducted for the work currently underway in the tunnel's access via the Europa 4 tunnel. With an environmental management plan implemented for the work currently underway in the tunnel's access by the Europa 4 tunnel.
Question number 31, the Honourable Ken Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, with an environmental impact assessment conducted for the work currently underway in the tunnel's access by the Europa 4
tunnel. The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, both environmental and heritage assessments were indeed carried out by officials from the Department of Environment, Heritage and Climate Change in consultation with experts. As part of the ongoing environmental management inspection, the Department has been regularly monitoring the work and liaising with the appointed contractor to ensure that no significant ecological impacts occur within the reserve. There has been no washing out of the tunnels.
Mr. Speaker, could the Minister advise who those experts were who were consulted, and would he be able to make those reports that were made available to him?
Mr. Speaker, the experts consulted included the Gibraltar Museum, the Ornithological National History Society, and the Gibraltar Heritage Trust. I am not aware of the format in which those comments are made, but I am very happy if he writes to me to look into it and to make it available.
And Mr. Speaker, the Minister is absolutely certain that at no point during the building exercise, the building construction phase, up to this point, has anyone effectively blocked out the tunnels in the hole or cleared out any rubbish that was in the tunnel and flushing with water.
Okay, I saw the post on Facebook where this was claimed to have happened. And the following morning, I took over these things very seriously. I was very upset at the allegation. I was there on site the following morning at 8 o'clock. I personally inspected the area. I determined that there was no evidence of flushing, certainly no significant flushing of any type. There was litter that had resulted as a result of a digging operation, which I personally helped in collecting and removing. But certainly there was no evidence at all of the alleged flushing by loads of dirty water, which was simply not the case. I was there myself, I took photographs, and a colleague, a senior member of the Department of Environment and Climate Change, was there with me. It is an area that I love and have worked very hard to protect through the decades. And I took it very seriously, and I personally inspected the site that had been most flushing of any significance.
Question number 42, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, following on from question 326, 2017, can government confirm that the East Side Waypower generator is still serviceable and whether it has suffered any periods of unserviceability since the 1st of June 2017, and if so, provide details of these?
I'm the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, I'll answer this question together with questions 33 to 45.
Question number 33, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
Speaker, following on from question 323 of 2017. When has been the average monthly output and peak output of the East Side Wave Generator since the 1st of June 2017?
Question number 34, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
What proportion of the power generated in Gibraltar is produced from renewable energy sources?
Question number 35, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
Has government set targets for production of power from renewable energy sources, and if so, could the Minister describe these targets?
I am the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, the East Side Wave Power Generator is still serviceable. However, being a prototype Wave Power Generator, it will occasionally undergo modifications in order to enhance its efficiency, and when these are ongoing, it might indeed be out of service. The Wave Generator average monthly output since 2017 has been 82.5 kilowatt hours. Peak output was 3.2 kilowatt hours. In 2017, a total of 93,048 kilowatt hours were generated from renewable sources and fed into the network. In addition, there are also solar panel installations at the GSLA, Victoria Stables of Infirmary Hall, Tanza View, and St. Bernard Hospital, which contributes to reducing the amount of power generated conventionally in the water. The total is estimated to be around 1% of total generation. Government's aim is to achieve a minimum of 20% from renewables by 2020.
Question number 36, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
Can the government confirm that the safety report for the LNG facility being reviewed by the competent authority is not required by Directive 2012/18/EU?
I'm for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 37.
Question number 37, the Honourable Tim Hammond.
Can government confirm that the documents that they published prior to the last election and presented to the public as LNG safety reports were not the safety reports required by Directive 2012/18/EU and did not contain the information mandated by that document, and that the latter document is at present under the scrutiny of the competent authority and has not yet been published?
I am the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The safety report has been submitted in compliance with Part 2A of the Public Health Act, Section 95F, and is being assessed by the Health and Safety Executive on behalf of the Environmental Agency, which is the competent authority. The report, Gibraltar LNG Storage, 3-consented valves, and 3-zone map for the shell proposal, was made public by the government on the 12th of November 2015. And was approved by the UK HSC in accordance with UK standard procedures. This report is presented over and above the legal requirements of the Directive 2012/18/EU as contained in the Gibraltar Law. The HSC and Health and Safety Executive considered the report and produced a 3-zone map which confirmed the suitability of the project to progress to the next stage. In addition, it should be noted the strict standards that apply to the report published by the Gibraltar Government in November 2015 for a careful and thorough analysis of the proposal for LNG storage and not an unreliable attempt at scaremongering, as the report published by the Honourable Member of the Group, which was funded by a Russian-backed competitor himself in an episode of political skullduggery, Mr. Speaker, which the people passed judgment on the 26th of November 2015, delivering to members of it the worst general election results in 25 years.
So, Mr. Speaker, the minister is confirming then that when we were talking about safety reports, and the only safety report that actually matters in all of this is that one prescribed by Directive 2012-18-EU, the one which we all thought was in the government hands and was supposed to have been published, and which the government perhaps suggested was the relevant safety report to the people of Gibraltar, when in fact it wasn't the safety report that is mandated and required by the EU, and indeed the safety report that contains all the essential and critical information with respect to liquid natural gas. Is it not the case that when the government issued that report, what they essentially did was make the public believe that they were issuing the appropriate safety report under Directive 2012, when in fact it was nothing of the sort and contained none of that information, and that report has still not been made public because it is still under the scrutiny, and will the government make that report public now?
Okay, this is relating to what the Chief Minister has just said, that is, to remove the word from my mouth, and to bear that away over. Mr. Speaker, if the member of it really wants to rekindle the debate, which is called the ethically rejected by the people of the world, I'll take it on.
If he wants to do that, and the honourable member wishes to engage him in that, he will have to bring a motion to the House, because I'm not going to allow that this afternoon.
Also, we are not here to go over the event to the general election of 2015.
Okay? Mr. Speaker, I will then keep it very brief, and thank you for that advice, which I will take with great pleasure. I disagree in that the only report that matters is the one that's coming. All of these reports have been done with the utmost diligence by all the top experts. The report that we published in November 2015, the law did not require us to publish, but we published it nonetheless, and was completely and thoroughly scrutinized by HSC. There is an additional report, which is currently going through the process, which is the report that will be published, which concerns the pre-construction, which was passed and vetted by HSL, and therefore the construction has proceeded, and the pre-operational report, which is in the process of a very thorough discussion, and which will, of course, be published once it is completed. And I can tell you, Mr. Speaker, just to offer a little bit more information, that the intensity and the thoroughness which we are dealing with this matter is much more than fair has ever had to bear anywhere else in the world.
Question number 38, the Oliver Allen Center.
Mr. Speaker, can the government advise how many tenders it has received on the 27th of November 2017 for the, quote, the provision of urban and street cleaning at people, public areas, and other public facilities, unquote, and have only been accepted and what contract amount?
Thank you for the only relation to the environment, energy, climate change, and education.
This is our answer to this question today with questions 42 and 43 from the Honourable Lady.
Question number 42, the Honourable Lady Salon.
With reference to the future of the current National Service workforce, how are their interests going to be guaranteed vis-à-vis the successful supplier?
Question number 43, the Honourable Ms. M.D. Salon.
with reference to the future of the current master service workforce, can government guarantee that the successful supplier will manage the workforce and all the work specified within the tender document for public cleaning and that there will be no subcontracting?
And for the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, four tenders were received in the first phase of a two-phase tender process. These four applications are currently being assessed to be shortlisted and invited to submit price bids. Therefore, this contract has not yet been awarded. The tender documents specifically make reference to treaty provisions. All four tender submissions have stated in their bid that there will be no subcontracting. In any event, the government of Gibraltar would not have allowed this in the same way that it does not allow the current contractor to subcontract. The government will, in the contract negotiations, be working in the interest of both the taxpayer and the workforce, given that we see those interests as being aligned. We will not allow current terms and conditions to be eroded and will be seeking improvement where commercially possible.
Mr. Speaker, with reference to question 42, with regard to key personnel in the document, in the draft service agreement or paper, service agreement, with regard to key personnel, what role does government envisage that they will play in connection with the new setup? I ask because schedule 5 in the draft service agreement that deals with key personnel is empty. So,
I'm not sure whether the Honourable Lady is referring to what will happen once the tender is awarded or during the negotiations in the tender.
It's ambiguous to me, if I ask, because I don't understand what key personnel is now in master services. What is the current definition of key personnel?
To the amount of detail that I am being requested, and I would be very happy to look into and to seek clarification. But the November is making reference to a specific section in a very vast document, and I wouldn't like to try and give a posting to the answer is without checking the facts. I think it would be reasonable to at least be given notice, and I'm happy to respond if the Honourable Lady wants to write to me. In the meantime, I will speak to the person.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you to the Honourable Gentleman. I will write to him and speak to the person. There is in clause 13.2, it talks about the government having the power to get people dismissed as the authority, that they won't be the employer. If the license is unfair dismissal, if the fallout would be for the employer, not for the authority, so how would that work appropriately?
I believe that this is exactly the same as is currently in the present contract. And the government has never exercised that ability in our time. It may have happened before our time. Because it is an exclusive government contract, there may be very rarely occasions in which the government has categorically, if there has been any particular misconduct and so on, and therefore it would have to perhaps take certain action. It is highly unlikely that it can happen. I cannot envisage anything that would trigger that in the normal run of things. But it is something that the government does reserve as an option in the public interest, and because it is a considerably large contract, taking a large amount of taxpayers in
it. Mr. Speaker, I said thank you for that. If I could just ask one more question, because I am aware that the union and representing the bulk of the master service workers have been trying to achieve a meeting with the Honourable Gentleman. At what point will the union be brought in to guarantee their existing and improved terms and conditions for the workforce?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. There have been meetings where the concerns of the members have been made to me directly and to the Chief Minister directly and to both of us together. They have raised a number of concerns
We have reassured them at meetings, we reassured them at the motion that we had in Parliament just a few months ago, and I think that my closing paragraph in my answer to question 43 should further reassure them that we will have the interest of the workforce very, very much at heart. It's paramount for us. So I think they need to be reassured that we will continue discussing, and that clearly the concept of the word is the government and not by the union, that obviously the union's view will be very much taken to heart. Okay. Mr. Speaker, let me ask you, the Minister, do we have an idea when the tender process will be complete and when we'll be in a position to award the contract? Mr. Speaker, there was a tender board appointed. It is run by senior officials in the government. I am not directly involved. I can speak that information, but I don't have it at this moment.
Question number 49, the Honourable E.J. Haynes.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Defence provide updated information in respect to the new buildings and refurbishment of schools which government announced it will be undertaking, together with a schedule of completion dates, details of the contractors carrying out each project, and the estimated cost of each project?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I provided the completion date in my answer to question 711 of 2017. There has been no change. The contractor for Metro Bank School is DJBS. The other projects have not been allocated. Estimated costs cannot be made public as we are engaged in a competitive procurement process.
Not even the estimated cost for the one already awarded.
No, Mr. Speaker, because potential contractors could take the estimated cost of the one that we are embarking as an idea of what we may or may not be willing to consider. And we feel that we should not preempt the issue, and therefore we do not feel that it is correct at this time to reveal the estimated cost of the one that we have begun.
And Mr. Speaker, here I make a speaker reference the government intends to publish the full cost once it has awarded all the projects to the contractors. If you intend to publish that in his own accord, or would the minister like me to re-table this question in a few months' time? Unless you can give a phone call now, I'll make a note and table it in a few months' time.
I cannot say when this matter that this will become public in due course, and the other member has the right to ask whatever question he wishes to ask, so I don't think I can comment any further on that.
Question number 40, the Honourable John Hayes.
Can government confirm it is that this has recently entered into a commitment with the Gibraltar Teachers Association to carry out a major review of their salary structure?
I will be able to listen to the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, this is not the case.
Question number 41, the Honourable Alexander.
Mr. Speaker, can the government update this paragraph with the provision of a new bus for St. Martin's School?
Thank you, the Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
Mr. Speaker, I'm surprised that the Honourable Member hasn't set up a non-line questionnaire asking what make of bus he should get. And that is essentially for a few hours to ensure he puts 802 times the billion. Mr. Speaker, the bus is scheduled to arrive in March.
We now move to question number 70, the Honourable Aaron Clinton.
Mr. Speaker,
can be done to advise that we've reached agreement for the Water Federation of Small Businesses on their joint review of the current, and I quote, cumbersome business licensing process. And then does the government anticipate bringing amendments to legislation to Parliament?
I shall be able to make it to Congress. Mr. Speaker, I'll answer this question together with question 83. Question number 8 is to the Honourable E.J. Phillips. Can the government state its position with regard to the regulation of real estate agents? I shall be able to make it to Congress. Mr. Speaker, one member asked on the bill to amend the Fair Trading Act to be brought to Parliament. The bill was published on the 5th of October 2017, and we are finalising the regulations in preparation for the approval of this bill by Parliament. The government has conducted its own review of the Fair Trading Act, which will be in the proposals of the Chamber of Commerce and the GFSC, and we have extensively consulted with them in respect of these. We are currently awaiting our final comments on the details, the business of which have already been agreed. Mr. Speaker, the regulation of estate agents is governed by the Fair Trading Act.
Can the Minister clarify as to what code of conduct is relevant to the real estate agents in the building?
Mr. Speaker, the Fair Trading Act and the regulations that impose standard terms of trade within the fish proposal. It goes beyond in terms of time to time, now purple applies in terms of money laundering and items of value. So the regulations are there already. I think I need to give my friend a little bit of
that. Just to clarify the Minister, he mentioned the bill that was published in the 5th of October 2017. And now leading over is to do with exchange of information and distribution of certain functions of business working authorities, but not necessarily the review to which he's referring, which I assume must still be subject to agreement in order to be being sent to a bill to life. And that, I guess what I'm saying is that this particular bill is kind of doesn't address the concerns of the various chambers.
Speaker, that bill that he referred to also says, and I read, an act to appeal certain provisions into a number of the Fair Trade Act related to business licensing, which is what the question is about, in particular with regard to the dissolution of the functions of the Business Licensing Authority, which is what I'm consulting on, and to provide the terms of information intelligence. So, yes, this is the bill which will enable us to introduce the regulations which are in discussions with the GFSB and the Chamber of Commerce. Question number 71, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
Mr. Speaker, does the government intend to retain the right of licensed entities to apply to court for stay of decisions of the Divorce and Financial Services Commission pending determination of any appeal against decisions of that body?
This will be able to answer for comment. Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 72 to 82. Question number 72, the Honourable D.A. Seaton.
I think we are not going to get very far today.
How many appeals to the Supreme Court and decisions of the FSC were filed in 2017? Question number 73, the Honourable D.A. Seaton. How many times has the FSC appointed inspectors under Section 101 of the Financial Services Open Brackets Insurance Companies Closed Brackets Act 1987 to investigate the affairs of anyone carrying a suspected Italian on insurance business in each of the calendar years since 2007? Question number 74, the Honourable D.A. Seaton. In relation to the preceding question of the affirmative inspectors in the Section 101, please state whether the organisation for whom the inspector worked consulted or was a partner at the time of the appointment was both in or outside the broker, and what did each appointment ultimately cost the entity investigated. Question number 75, the Honourable D.A. Peter. How many payments of inspectors have been made in the Section 8 of the Financial Service to Open Brackets Information Gathering and Corporation Code Brackets Act 2013 in each calendar year since that act was introduced? Question number 76, the Honourable D.A. Peter. How many payments of poor persons have been made under Section 7 of the Financial Services Information Gathering and Corporation Act 2013 in each calendar year since that act was introduced? Question number 77, the Honourable D.A. Peter. In respect of your payments made under Section 7 and 8 of the Financial Services Information Gathering and Corporation Act 2013 since that act was introduced, please state whether the organisation for whom the inspector's poor persons appointed work and cycle that was a partner was based in or outside Gibraltar. Question number 78, the Honourable D.A. Peter. How many appointments of hybrid skilled persons with the powers of inspectors have been made by the FSC in agreement with licensed entities in calendar year since 2013? Question number 79, the Honourable D.A. Peter. In respect of hybrid appointments of skilled persons with the powers of inspectors, please state whether the organisation to whom the inspector or skilled person appointed work and cited was a partner was based in or outside the building. Question number 80, the Honourable D.A. Peter. In respect of A, the appointments made under Section 7 and 8 of the Financial Service Open Brackets Information Gathering and Corporation Code Brackets Act 2013, since that act was introduced, and being hybrid appointments of skilled persons with powers of inspectors since 2013, what was the cost to each granting entity of those appointments? Question number 81, the Honourable D.A. Peter. Can the government please provide details of the 50 licenses that the CEO of the FSC told GBC on the 18th of December 2017 had been issued in the areas of insurance, pensions, and banking? Number 82, the Honourable D.A. Peter. During her interview with GBC on the 18th of December 2017, the CEO of the FSC said there had been a new approach to enforcement by the FSC. Is the government content with this new approach? Question the Honourable Minister for Commerce. Speaker, firms will continue to have the right to apply to court to save the business of the GFSC. And in 2017, there were 21 appeals from 11 firms to the Supreme Court. Since 2007, no inspector has been appointed on Section 101 of the Financial Services Insurance Companies Act, 1987, to investigate insurance activities, and consequently, the answer to Question 74 of 2008 is no firm is engaged to carry out this work. Under Section 8 of the Financial Services Information Gathering Corporation Act, one inspector was appointed in 2014, and four inspectors were appointed in 2017. Under Section 7 of the same Act, no skilled persons have been appointed since the Act was introduced, and since 2013, one hybrid skilled person with the powers of an inspector has been appointed. All persons appointed under the Act have been confirmed in Gibraltar and the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, where firms have paid money to meet the cost of inspectors, where skilled persons have been Section 7 and 8 of the Act, where hybrid appointments of skilled persons, that information is confidential to the firm. In respect of fees incurred by the GFSC themselves, the GFSC in its annual report provides details of all these payments made to firms. In 2017, there were 47 new licenses issued, which naturally included 70 practitioners, statutory auditors, and individual directorships, and a further 4 were license extensions. All of these, Mr. Speaker, are on the GFSC website. The government is content with the enforcement strategy of the GFSC.
Mr. Speaker, just in relation to the policy mechanism that the government is going to engage in terms of the breakdown, can you actually provide me with an actual breakdown of the 50 licenses? Yes.
Speaker, the firms themselves where licenses granted are online. I'm not going to give you the firms. The government areas, 8 and authorized 1, 8 and registered 5, bank extension 1, building drawings 1,
Category 3, Investment Firm 1, Capital Manager 4, ERS 6, ERS Director 2, E-Money Institution 1, General Insurance Intermediary 1, Individual Company Manager 8, Insurance Practitioner 1, Insurance Sales 3, Insurance Company 6, which includes 3 expenses, Insurance Intermediary General 1, Insurance Manager 6, Personal Pension Scheme Controller 1, Statutory Auditor 2. We now return to question number 47. Questioner is the Honourable R. M. Clinton.
Can I just go back to Minister of Defence for the question 82 and just ask him if he's entirely satisfied or he identifies himself with the comments from the Paris who said that the new strategy regime that were coming to force over the next year will look and smell a lot like the UK. Is that the government's intention?
The question 82 was on the sector's enforcement strategy, and the enforcement strategy has been in place since 2016. I'm not sure if this question is in any way related to it. Just because of the LRP program, that may be what I think you're picking up on, which I haven't seen or heard that quote or read that quote, so I may want to address that okay, but I can tell you that the LRP is a government program, which we're working to hand it on to the FSC. And is subject of extensive consultation with the Finance Centre Council and will be the subject of further public consultation before then. So it's not as if the LRP is in the ownership of the FSC, we are working with them. It's very much government driven, it is legislation, and therefore there will be full and complete consultation with the sector, even though we've already started that with the Finance Centre Council in France, which is the most manageable way to do with it. We are comfortable that we will get the results that we want.
Question number 47, the Honourable Alan Simpson.
Mr. Speaker, can we then advise how many expressions of interest forms have been received in respect to the new affordable housing scheme announced on 28 September 2017?
I think the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, a total of 4,087 questionnaires have been received since the 28th of September
2017. Question number 48, the Honourable E. Johnson. Can we have your position in relation to the regulation of private landlords? I think the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, the regulation of private landlords is provided for in the Housing Act 2007. This Act, and particularly the provisions that relate to commercial residential landlords, is currently under review.
Question number 49, the Honourable Ellis Yammer.
Mr. Speaker, why is the government delaying the coming into force of the Disability Act 2017 debated in this House in July of last year?
I am the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, government is not delaying the coming into force of the Disability Act. May I remind the Honourable Gentleman that this government has pioneered legislation that will give people with disabilities more rights and respect within our community, something that no previous government has delivered. It is normal practice when large pieces of legislation are introduced that they not come into force immediately and that their implementation be staggered so that everyone is familiar with the obligations under the Act. I made this clear and said that extensive training and awareness would be provided on the legislation ahead of it coming into force, and this is exactly what we have been doing to ensure that the legislation is an absolute success.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member has a schedule by when she estimates the staggering of the effective date to be.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and as I have said before, we have a schedule that will deliver some. I have said, Mr. Speaker, that part of the introduction of the legislation will be staggered. Some sections of the legislation will be introduced even sooner than others. But the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, needs to understand that this legislation primarily relates to government policy. And he can be rest assured that government policy is up to speed on matters of equality, inclusion, and disability, and all the policies are being applied throughout the government in a way that is unprecedented.
Mr. Speaker, if you would allow this supplementary, would indeed the Disability Act debate be and prior to that debate coming to the House, we had a private conversation in which the other ladies assured me that there would be guidelines being published as from September in areas where the legislation is not being introduced because the domestic legislation already provides for that. So if the Honourable Lady has an estimated date for when those guidelines will be published, is that an estimation?
Mr. Speaker, in fact, the guidance booklet that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to that I explained, I would be issuing as a further assistance and guidance in the successful implementation of this landmark legislation have already been published. I think for memory, I'm sure that we have published two and possibly three. We are publishing them as we go. In fact, we are publishing them in order to deliver the training so that people have a point of reference when they undergo the training, people in particularly internally in different government departments so that they have a point of reference on what is required from them in terms of policy and in the legislation.
Question number 50, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Mr. Speaker, both the government have a plan to provide support of independent living for members of our community who suffer from mental health problems.
I to the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, there are now various types of provision of supportive and independent living for people with mental health problems. What is offered is person-centred and according to individual needs. There is residential accommodation provided at the new Ocean View for some patients who have been clinically described that require a high level of supervision and support. As a result of collaboration between the Housing Department and the GHA, there now also exists flats in the community which are staffed by clinical carers provided by the GHA mental health services. Furthermore, for those who are independent, they will live in the community without the support provided via the GHA or the care agency. And finally, Mr. Speaker, in addition, the Housing Department has developed a protocol with the GHA in the event that an existing tenant may require support so that referrals and assistance are seamlessly provided.
Question number 51, the Honourable Ellis Yamas.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, Canada Government provides details of applicants for the housing waiting list who have had their applications backdated, including A, the date the application was accepted, B, the list the applicant was placed on, C, the position on the list the applicant went to him, D, the date the applicant was removed from the list, E, the type of property the applicant obtained on removal from the list, in terms of government rentals, affordable housing, or other.
I see the Honourable Minister for Housing and Equality.
Mr. Speaker, since December 2011, a total of 11 applications have been backdated. Details are as follows. A, 8 applications were accepted in 2012, 2 in 2013, and 1 in 2016. All the applicants were on the waiting list. In relation to C, the information is not reflected in our records. And D, 1 applicant was removed in 2012, 1 in 2013, 4 in 2014, 3 in 2015, 1 in 2017, and 1 in 2018. All properties allocated were government rented.
Question number 52, the owner named Andrew Hassanon.
Can the Minister for Housing explain the lack of statistical information in respect of housing matters on the government website? Mr. Speaker, we have noticed some errors in the information that was being uploaded. And as a result of this, we carried out an in-depth review of the whole system. The new format has now been agreed, and the Housing Department is in the process of inputting the statistics in the new format and will upload them as soon as they're ready. Mr. Speaker, the same question was posed almost 1 year ago by my Honourable friend to my right, Edwin Reyes, and the Honourable Lady then said, quote, discrepancies and inaccuracies in the presentation of the data were noticed. The complete system is currently under review in order that the statistics going forward are presented as accurately as possible. I hope the exercise is complete within 6 months. So I'd like to ask why it's still an ongoing issue and why, if a year ago we were referring to the statistics of the year before, why aren't the statistics of the last year? And now, why are they being treated in the same way as the problem that had occurred a year ago with the year before? Yeah, they're already given a reason. It's got nothing to do with them being either this year or last year. It's that they were wrong. They were being collated in the wrong manner, unfortunately. And they were not being presented in a manner that I thought was helpful. And that is why, Mr. Speaker, I ask that there be a review in the way that we gather the information and that we present the information in a way that is obviously accurate and more relevant to anybody who is checking the statistics. The information needs to be drawn from various departments, and that's where the main source of the confusion is coming from, because we have to rely on statistics provided to us by the Housing Department and by the Housing Works Agencies and various other entities as well. And it just happened that figures weren't matching. But we have looked at the whole system. It's unfortunately taken the department a bit longer than we envisaged, but I was presented with the new draft format at a meeting, I think, some 2 weeks ago. The whole format has been agreed, and it's a question of the department just getting the information up to date so that it can all be uploaded at once. Thank you for your answer, Ed. Considering that we're already 6 months past the timing that the Honourable Lady gave us, how much longer are we to wait before we can expect the statistics to be up and running again? I know that the department has been working very hard on this, which is something, of course, that they need to do over and above the day-to-day business of the running of the Housing Department and the hundreds and hundreds of calls that they receive on a daily basis from members of the public. As I just said in the answer to the previous supplementary, I was presented with a final review of what was going to be presented, and the department is currently in the process of analysing the data that's going to be presented. I don't think it will take very long. I would envisage maybe a couple of weeks. I know that the department is giving it a lot of priority, but priority in the whole context of allocating flats as soon as possible and dealing with repairs and dealing with the ordinary day-to-day business of the department.
We move to question number 84, the Honourable E.J. Phillips.
Can you update the House on the development of key worker housing?
Also, the Honourable Deputy Chief Minister.
In reference to that, a total of redevelopments comprising 382 studio apartments and 139 one bedrooms have been taken before the Development and Planning Committee and described by the applicants as key worker accommodation.
Number 85,
The Honourable Alan Fenton.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide any expressions of interest we received on the 21st of December 2017 for the Bayside, St. Anne's and St. Martin's schools respectively, and have any been accepted and exposed to that consideration?
I will be able to Dr. Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, the government has received two expressions of interest for the Bayside school sites, two for the Hillary school sites, and five for the Martin school sites. They came in just before the Christmas break and are still under consideration.
I'm grateful to the Minister for example. Do we have an idea to when we will be determined? Is we thinking of next month or 6 months or what time we follow? And what time frame?
The expression is still under consideration. We're still looking at them, so it's really difficult to determine at this stage how long that process is going to take.
Thank you. And would it be the government's intention that the assessment of interest, if they are accepted, that there would be payments in advance for the site being vacated, or would it allow the sale to go through after the site has been vacated?
This is the part of the negotiation which would have whichever entity turn out to be successful in this process.
Okay, so and the speaker that I'm telling you correctly, the government at the moment has not set out a negotiating position as to what it is we would prefer.
The government hasn't yet decided with which of the parties it wants to negotiate, that's neither the percentage of negotiation will be. Once we establish and we analyze the content towards the different expressions of interest, we'll be in a better position to answer that question.
Just one final question to the Minister. Of the expressions of interest received, would you be able to advise if certainly for each of the three sites there has been one particular tender that has tended for three sites.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I may clarify there has been a tender that has tended for each of the three sites. So I will be able to answer that question because I don't want to mislead the House, but I'm not absolutely sure. Just a reminder, I would be kind enough to take that question again in the next meeting of the House, but I will have the information before me at that point.
Question number 86, the Oliver Ellis Dollar.
Mr. Speaker, I'm the Deputy Chief Minister of State precisely what interest the Chinese and leading nations of the Commonwealth have shown in Gibraltar, following his statement with his New Year's message to that effect.
I will be able to get into two
Mr. Speaker, the interest that exists is commercial and economic. In relation to China, this is being driven by my colleague, the Minister for Economic Development, Federal Designer, and also the Minister for Commerce, I give it to them. The interest in the part of Commonwealth countries, by most of commercial and economic, comes in the context of a decision taken by the United Kingdom to leave the European Union, and the new trading relationships that are expected to emerge post Brexit. There is also a political dimension to this.
Mr. Speaker, thanks for that answer. Would the Deputy Chief Minister be able to provide details of which are the leading countries in the Commonwealth we're trying to be included in?
Some of those are public, and we've made announcements of the countries that we met. Others are the government
say the only one that has the fear of the house, because in our experience, then those countries get written to by third parties, and we'd rather avoid that situation. So but I'm very happy to call him in the chamber, outside the chamber.
I'm left with no doubt that the Honourable Samuel MP KCMG has left the chamber to avoid us once again tributing him for the award that he's received from Her Majesty the Queen. I warned him that he would once again engage in tributes before the recess and before the adjournment, and he quickly decided that he would leave the chamber rather than suffer again the ignominy of us telling him how much we value him and his contribution to public life. Mr. Speaker, I could now adjourn the House to Monday the 29th of January at 2:30 in the afternoon. With your assistance to members, I intend to deal with the remaining business of the House on that day and adjourn to the DA if time allows at the end of the evening.
The House will now adjourn to Monday the 29th of January at 2:30 in the afternoon.